I was deep cover at LitaCorp, working as a lab tech on their Psy research that Gray commissioned. You heard about that program, right? He waited until I nodded before continuing. My original objective was just to keep an eye on how things were going. Alvin wanted to know what kinds of tests they were running and if they had figured anything out. But I was also supposed to report back if I thought it was possible to extract any kids from the program. You did, I said, making the link so suddenly it surprised even me. Nico. That was the testing program he was in. Cole hunched his shoulders against the stream of water. He was the only subject that was strong enough to be taken out. The others were just... I can't describe it to you without it sounding like a horror show.
How did you get him out?
Simulated cardiac arrest and death, he said. The disposal service the lab used was called, but the League picked him up first.
My brain was firing at a rapid pace, drumming up one horrible possibility after another.
So the intel on that flash drive, it was research that you stole?
Yeah. Something like that.
Something like that? I repeated in disbelief. I don't even get to know what's on the stupid thing.
He hesitated long enough that I was sure he wouldn't actually tell me.
Think about it. What's the one thing every parent of a dead kid wants to know? The one thing scientists have been after for years?
The cause of the Psy disease.
Are you?
No, he wasn't kidding. Not about this.
I can't give you details. I didn't have time to look through the research before I downloaded everything. But I heard the talk in the lab that afternoon when they concluded their experiments. They had proof the government is responsible for all of this.
Cole clenched his hands into tight fists.
Though the fact that they shuttered the lab and permanently silenced all of the scientists the day after I got picked up by PSFs should be proof enough for most people.
Did you tell Alban? I asked. No wonder he was so desperate.
Not until I got back, and I had to think up some excuse for why my cover was blown. I told him I downloaded it, but it set off some silent security system. I'm sure my pride will recover from that in about 1,000 years.
Cole sighed.
I was afraid if I told him what I had, the agents here would already have figured out how to use it before I even got back with it.
Cole's fingers tapped at his side.
I couldn't tell him before and risk the news getting ahead of me. As disconnected from HQ as I was, I saw things were changing here. People I knew and trusted were being shuffled out to the other bases, and people I didn't like all of a sudden had Alban's ear. It was enough to make a guy a little uncomfortable, you know?
I nodded.
I knew if I had something real to offer Alban, Cole continued, there'd be a good chance we could outmaneuver the agents trying to change the League. But if word got around here what it was, they'd be able to start planning ways to use it. That intel is the currency we need to buy this joint back from the bad seeds, to convince Alban to stick with us. It's the only way to outgun them at the staff table when their plan starts looking like the only real option we have.
Random bursts of Rob and Alban's argument were blasting in my ears. Big statement. Children. Camps.
If this intel is so important, how did you get it out of Lita in the first place? Sewed the damn flash drive into the lining of my jacket. I walked right out of the building with it because I was on the security team, and my buddies there didn't feel the need to frisk me. I knew someone would be alerted I downloaded the files, but I used one of the scientists' network IDs. He said, "Easiest damn thing I'd ever done." By the time they figured out she was innocent, I was going to be long gone, until my precious little brother saw the PSFs coming toward my apartment while I was out getting us food. He bailed and grabbed my jacket instead of his by mistake.
If Cole hadn't looked so angry about it, I'm not sure I would have believed him. I was torn between laughing and beating his head into the concrete wall behind us. How could you have been so stupid? I asked. How could you make such a dumb mistake? You've put his life in danger.
The important thing is that we can still get the intel back.
The most important... I was almost too outraged to string a sentence together. Liam's life is more important than that stupid flash drive.
My, my.
A feral grin spread across Cole's face.
Little brother must be a good kisser.
The rage flared up in me so fast, so strong, that I actually forgot to slap him. Go to hell, I said, and tried to charge past him. Cole caught me again and pushed me back, chuckling. My hand twitched at my side. Let's see who'd be laughing when I fried every single thought out of his brain. The same idea must have crossed his mind, because Cole released me and took a step back. Have you at least been able to establish contact with him since you got back? I asked.
He's dropped off the radar,
Cole said, crossing his arms over his wide chest. The fingers on his left hand tapped against his right arm.
Funny thing about him not realizing the payload he's carrying. I can't predict where he might take it or try going. It means it's next to impossible to track the little jerk-ass, other than to assume he's still trying to find our mom and stepdad. Chaos theory at its finest.
Why are you telling me this?
Because you're the only one who can do something about it.
The steam overtook his shape and he disappeared into it.
Nope. Listen to me. I've been made. The League won't let me out of HQ. I won't even be able to run ops. Never mind search the Eastern Seaboard for a fugitive.
Once they realize our little fictional informant isn't real, they're going to start going through the other options. They're going to ask themselves, who's the only person these two strangers both know? They're going to ask, who would this girl do anything to protect? I bristled, crossing my arms. Cole's eyes flicked down from my face to where my shirt clung to my chest, and I raised my arms that much higher. He let out a thoughtful hum, an absent-minded smile stealing back over his face.
Have to say, you're not really his type. Mine, on the other hand.
You know what I think? I said, taking a step closer.
Not really, darling, but I have a feeling I'm going to hear it anyway.
You're actually a lot more worried about Liam than you are about this intel. You want me to find him to make sure he's okay. That's the real reason you're asking me instead of someone else. Cole scoffed. His shirt had wilted against his skin with the steam, and it was impossible not to look at the strong lines of his shoulders as he set them.
Sure, fine. Run with that theory. But can you stop thinking about my brother's dreamy eyes for 2 damn seconds and put your head on straight?
This isn't about him or me. It's a matter of making sure that we control the intel so we can bring it to Alvin and shut the door on Meadows and all of his little buddies. You have no idea what kind of shit they want the organization to start pulling. What they do to you kids if they got their way. And they will if we don't figure out a way to outplay them. You think we can keep this up without making a big statement? Rob's words echoed back to me. What are they planning? Something to do with us and the camps? The water sputtered between us. The timer they'd installed to limit the use of hot water clicked off. The water was still flowing, but it was cooling off to its usual frigid temperature, and neither of us moved.
His big idea, Cole began, his voice brittle, is to use some of the non-essential kids here and the information you provided about the camps. You know, the ones too young to be activated, some of the greens.
To do what? I demanded.
You said in your report that they don't search or pat down the kids who are supposedly pre-sorted as green, right?
He waited until I nodded before continuing.
That was backed up by one of the other kids we pulled from a smaller camp. Meadows thinks that their intake security procedures have become lax over the past year. Since there are so few kids left outside of the camps, they're usually only bringing a few in at a time.
That and the PSFs are stretched too thin at the bigger camps.
That's true, I said. I'd noticed the number of soldiers decrease over the years at Thurmond as the camp reached maximum capacity, and they closed it off to new arrivals. But decreasing the bodies present only translated to them increasing the weapons present, and the willingness to hit us with white noise any time anyone so much as looked on the verge of acting out.
He thinks?
Cole cleared his throat, pressing his good hand against it.
Meadows wants to strap explosives to the kids, turn them over to the PSFs, then set the bombs off as they're being driven into camps. He thinks it'll stir enough fear and discontent among the PSFs to get them to ditch their required service.
I didn't hear the last part. Not fully. There was a static in my ears that burned and burned and burned away every thought, every sound, everything outside of my racing thoughts.
If you think you're going to faint, sit your ass down, Cole ordered. I told you this because you're a big girl and I need your help. I know you didn't mean for this to happen, but you're in it, knee deep. You're as responsible for riding this as the rest of us.
I didn't sit, but the dark blotches in my vision were growing, expanding, swallowing his face. The other agents? They want to do this?
Not everyone, he said, but enough that if Albin weren't here, it wouldn't even be a question. Read between the lines there.
Oh my God. Kate knows about this, but she's still with him? Why would she stay with someone who could even think about something like that?
Connor is a smart woman. If she's with him, it's for a reason, and probably not the one you think. We've both seen how Meadows handles things.
Then you know that Jarvin handled Blake Howard? I asked. The kid he shot in the back on the op last night?
You know that for sure? He demanded. You have some kind of proof?
Security camera footage, I said. It was downloaded before anyone could wipe it remotely from here.
Keep it to yourself for now. When you bring the intel back, we'll take that to Albin, too. Nail Meadows and the others into their coffins.
I haven't agreed to anything yet.
You're killing me, kid, he said, rolling his eyes again. You'll go and find Liam. You'll bring the intel back. There's never been any doubt in my mind about it. Because, Jim, Cole said, smiling when I rolled my eyes at the new nickname, I know that you don't want Albin to figure out what really happened, and that Liam's involved. And I know you don't want to give him any reason to invest in Meadows' plan. And I'll make sure Albin does turn his attention to freeing the camps, the right way, the one you suggested in your report. That's what you've been after all this time, right? The reason you put together that whole packet of info for him? I know it wasn't to give Meadows a way to turn it against you.
You can find him. Want was overpowering the cooler, quieter, rational part of my brain. You can see him again. You can make sure he gets home this time. And you can help all of those kids, all of them.
If I agree to this, I started. You have to guarantee I won't be reprimanded when I get back for taking this little joyride. And you have to swear on the terms, because if you go back on your word, I will tear every thought out of your head until you're nothing but a drooling puddle of snot. Got it?
Atta girl, Cole said. That's my gem. I'll see if I can't get you on the next op back east. You'll have to get creative in how you ditch the minder they send with you, but I think you're up for the challenge. Address is 1222 West Bucket Road, Wilmington, North Carolina. Can you remember that? Start there. Lee's a creature of habit. He'll try heading home to see if our stepdad left a clue about where they were headed.
I took a deep breath. My body was completely still, but everything inside me seemed to be galloping. My heart, my thoughts, my nerves.
You can do this, Cole said quietly. I know you can. I'll have your back the whole way.
I don't need your protection,
I said. But Jude does.
The beanpole? Sure, I'll keep an eye on him.
And Vida and Nico.
Your wish is my command.
Cole gave a small little bow as he backed out of the curtain. I closed my eyes, trying to block out the familiar tilt of his smile and the way it made my chest feel like it would explode.
Pleasure doing business with you.
Hey, I said suddenly. If anyone might know, it would be another deep cover agent. Have you heard of an op they're calling Snowfall? An agent called Professor?
I think I've heard of Snowfall, but only that it was a project they were running in Georgia. Why? Want me to look into it for you?
I shrugged. If you have time.
I have all the time in the world for you, Jim. Trust me on that.
I was still standing there when the locker room door slammed shut and the last of the water drained at my feet. Two long, torturous weeks passed before I found the red folder in my locker. I felt each day tick by, went through the carefully structured routine of training, food, bed. I kept my head down, but my thoughts moving. I was too afraid to look anyone in the face on the off chance that he or she would see the guilt or what I was planning. I almost cried, half in relief, half in panic, when I saw the op folder balanced on my small stack of books. The locker room was roaring with speculation around me, one voice bleeding into another. Someone had been brave, or stupid, enough during our lesson for the day to ask Instructor Johnson what they had done with Blake's body and whether we'd have any kind of service for him. Nico had gone green around the gills, but Johnson had only waved the question off. Team 2's leader, a blue named Erica, was loudly airing her opinion that he was still down in the infirmary being studied, but another, a green named Jillian, insisted she had seen them take a body bag out through the tube a few days before. "They obviously buried him," she was saying. I stood by my locker, reading the folder behind the cover of the door. I could hear Vida a few feet away, laughing loudly at something another blue had suggested. When I turned, I craned my neck around, trying to look into her locker. Good. Nothing but the messy heap of shirts she had shoved in there. She would be here. I could tell Jude and Nico to stay close to her. No one would try anything with her there, not even Jarvin. There was too much sting in that honeybee. I opened the folder again, letting my eyes skim down each line. Please be East Coast, I thought. Please be back east. I could get to North Carolina so much easier from Connecticut than I could from Texas or Northern California. Op ID 349022A. TOD 15 December 1300 hours. Location Boston, Massachusetts. Massachusetts. I could work with that. Some of the train lines were still running. Objective. Pull Dr. P.T. Fishburn, Director of Administration Department of Genetics and Complex Diseases, Harvard School of Public Health. Disable lab. I felt my stomach clench. Pull, meaning I would interrogate him there in Boston at a league safe house, or if he proved to be uncooperative, we would bring him back to the nearest base. My job. Disable, meaning fry, destroy, demolish. The tactical team's job. Tact team, beta group. Psy, tangerine, sunshine. Minder, TBD. Oh, I whispered, feeling leaving my hands completely. Hell no. I left the folder in my locker and slammed it shut, twisted my wet hair back into a loose bun. I was out before anyone could notice I was gone. It was 3 p.m. If Kate wasn't in a meeting, she would be in her room, most likely, or in the atrium. A drip of water fell from my hair onto my cheek, and I swiped angrily at it, plowing through the hanging strips of plastic that were, in theory, supposed to help insulate what little warmth we had in HQ. I glanced up at the low ceilings to avoid making eye contact with yet another cluster of agents, stepping off to the side to allow them to pass. The hair on the back of my neck rose with each step that echoed behind me, keeping pace with my own. There was someone behind me. There had been, since I stepped out of the locker room. The heavy steps and the throaty gulps of air made me think it was a man. I glanced up as I passed one of the steel beams overhead, but whoever was following me was doing it at the exact right pace. I couldn't see his reflection, but I could feel him behind me, feel every ounce of his disgust for me cutting through the hallway's damp chill, gripping the column of my spine. "Don't look," I thought, clenching my jaw. "Just keep going." It was nothing. My mind was playing tricks, like it loved to do. It's nothing. It's no one. But I could feel him hovering behind me, like his fingers were trying to smooth down the goosebumps on my skin. There was no stopping the sudden upswing of my heartbeat. I knew what I could do and that I had enough training to fight someone off, but all I could think about was Blake Howard's shoe dangling off his pale, stiff toes in the infirmary. I found the double doors I'd been looking for and burst into the atrium, half out of breath. They were in the middle of setting the round tables and folding chairs again, returning the space to its usual use as a rec room. Here and there I saw agents dressed in their finest league sweats, doling out playing cards, watching the news on the TV screens, or even playing with a mismatched chess set. Kate came in through the opposite set of doors, cutting a sharp image in her unusually polished navy skirt suit. Her blonde hair was twisted back into a tight bun. She absently bumped into an agent sitting at a nearby table, murmuring a faint apology. I didn't realize she was looking for someone until her eyes landed on my face. "There you are," she said, jogging over the best she could in her heels. I opened my mouth, but she held up a hand to quiet me. "I know. I'm sorry. I did everything I could to change Alban's mind, but he insisted." "He's not 16 yet," I said. "He isn't ready. You know that. We all do. Are you trying to turn him into the next Blake Howard?"
"I might as well have socked her in the face." Kate reared back, a look of horror filtering through her usual mask of calm.
"I fought to get him off this, Ruby. I assigned Vida to go with you, but someone convinced Alban that Jude should be activated early. They need a yellow for the security system, and Alban said it didn't make sense to bring in two different teams on a simple op."
We were attracting a few stray glances. Kate took my arm and steered me over to an empty table, forcing me to sit down.
"You have to try harder," I insisted. "Our little sunshine didn't perform well in high-pressure situations, and he had the tendency to wander off to explore shiny things when he needed to be conducting surveillance. The only thing he knew about using a firearm was that the end with the hole needed to be pointed away from his face."
"He'll be 15 in a few weeks." Kate kept one hand on mine. I'm sure it'll be fine. This is a good, straightforward op to let him dip his toes in the water."
"I could do it by myself. If this involves sabotaging some kind of electrical equipment, I can..."
"My hands are tied, Ruby. I can't keep pushing back against Alban, or he'll start seeing me as a problem, and..."
She took a deep breath, absently smoothing first her hair, then her skirt. Her voice sounded stronger when she spoke again, but she wasn't looking at me now.
"The only comfort I have in all of this is knowing that he'll be with you and that you'll look after him. Can you do that?"
Her skin was hollow beneath her high cheekbones, like she had just recovered from a long illness. I leaned forward, noticing now the way her makeup had collected in the new, fine lines around her eyes, how dark the circles were that rimmed her eyes. She was only 28 and was already starting to look older than my mother had when I left her. Sometimes it felt like this was where I found the real Kate, in the pauses. I wouldn't describe our relationship as good, because it was built on a lie, and a pretty cruel one at that. She could say one thing and mean something else entirely. But right then, surrendered to the quiet, her face told me everything. I saw the struggle in the lines of her face and knew whatever words came next were more for the agents around us than they were for me.
"I have to go up north," she said in an even voice, "for an assignment."
Up north, meaning the surface streets of Los Angeles, meaning it probably had something to do with the Federal Coalition. Kate was a senior agent now. She'd earned her wings. If they were sending her up there, it was to do something important for Alban.
"So you won't be coming with us?" I asked.
Kate glanced behind me and waved at whomever she saw standing there. I felt something cold drip down the back of my neck, though my hair was nearly dry.
"There you are," Kate said. "I was just about to tell Ruby that she'll be in good hands on the op. You'll keep a careful eye on my girl, won't you?"
Rob had never, not since the first day I met him, willingly touched me. He, like the others, knew better. Still, I watched his hands where they hung at his sides, dark hair curling on the backs of his knuckles. My throat tightened.
"Don't I always?" Rob said with a faint chuckle.
Kate stood, her moon-pale face glowing in the artificial light.
"See you later, Gator."
It was her stupid, childish send-off, the same one she always gave us when she left. The others wouldn't have hesitated to finish her little rhyme. Jude had thought up the little goodbye as a play off her call sign. Now, I could barely choke the words out. "In an hour, Sunflower." As soon as they walked away, I saw Cole sitting at the other end of the room, an open book on the table in front of him. By the dark look on his face, it was more than clear he'd heard the entire conversation.
"You said you would protect him."
Was there really no one in the entire league I could trust? These people couldn't be counted on for anything. All of their promises bled into lies. Cole shook his head, turning his palms face up on the table. It was a weak, silent apology, but at least he understood. Shifting this one single piece on the board was enough to change the whole game.
6. They smuggled Jude and me into Boston in broad daylight, riding in the jump seats of a fat-bellied cargo plane. It was an older model than the one we'd used to fly back from Philadelphia, and its smell lent some possibility to Jude's theory it had once been used to move dead meat. I watched the enormous crates in front of us, trying to ignore the way they creaked under the strain of the straps holding them in place. All of them were marked with Lita Corporation's elegant golden swan, which felt like some kind of horrible wink from the universe. The rational part of me knew it didn't mean anything, that it wasn't some bad omen. We flew on Lita Corp's planes all the time. They'd realized the benefit of playing nice with both Gray and the Federal Coalition, which meant they had special privileges to travel to and from California to move their product. As uncooperative as always, Gray had the brilliant idea to try to starve the Federal Coalition out of California by forbidding imports into the state and exports out of it. Unfortunately for the rest of the country, California was where most of the fresh produce was, and they had easy access to the oil they were drilling in Alaska. The Federal Coalition was our matchmaker, though. We got to piggyback on flights like this in exchange for serving as their knife in the dark. Alban saw it as a fair trade for the intelligence we'd gathered and countless ops we'd run on their behalf over the years, though I knew he wanted more. Specifically, respect, money, and the promise that he'd be given a place in their new government once Gray was out. On the other side of the plastic-wrapped heap of crates was Beta Team, laughing at some joke that had been lost to the steady snarl of the engines. I pressed the backs of my freezing hands against my eyes, trying to ease the throbbing there. What little heat was still circulating in the cargo space must have been clinging to the ceiling, because I felt exactly none of it. I sank down lower in my seat, wrapping the black puffer coat as tightly around my center as I could with the seatbelt in the way.
"Deep breath in," Jude was chanting. "Deep breath out." Deep breath in, deep breath out. You are not in an airplane. You are floating through the sky. Deep breath in.
I think you actually have to be taking deep breaths for that to work, I told him.
The plane dipped, only to bob up a second later.
Is that... His voice cracked. Was that normal?
It's just a little turbulence, I told him, trying to pull away from his grip. It happens on every flight.
Jude had strapped a TACT team member's helmet to his head and a pair of goggles over his eyes. I didn't have the heart to tell him that if the plane went down, a head wound would be the least of his worries.
God, he couldn't handle the stress of a plane flight.
This was a mistake. I should have fought harder, argued, swayed someone to get Jude off this op. Back at HQ, the thought of having to bring him along to search for Liam had been frustrating, an annoying dose of reality to swallow. But now? Now I was just scared. How was he going to handle the pressure of escaping Rob and Beta Team if he couldn't sit still for 5 minutes? If his imagination had already stolen his courage and had made a run for it?
Maybe I can find a way to leave him with Barton, I thought, rubbing my forehead. The problem was, how did I know that Barton wasn't one of the agents who sided with Rob in arguing for attacking the camps? How did I know that any of his teammates wouldn't gladly put a bullet in Jude's skull, neat and easy?
This is going to be great! It's going to be so cool!
Jude's op folder was stained with specks of whatever he had eaten for dinner the night before, and he was looking a little soft around the edges.
I wanted to scream. Scream! It was another mouth to feed and another back to protect. Jude was the living embodiment of a distraction.
But what was the alternative here? Sending him back to that hellhole, hoping he'd still be there, alive, when I got back and Cole put his plan in action? No. Jude was dead weight. One I was going to have to carry on my shoulders the whole way. But I was stronger now. I could do it. I'd find Liam, and I'd keep both of them safe, because that was the only option. That was the only one I was willing to accept.
Bartlett, what do you think he does?
Jude asked. The pages fanned under his fingers.
I recognize the other names. Frances is nice. She gave me a candy bar once. I like Labrowski and Gold and Philman, too. Cool guys. They taught me how to play solitaire. And I like Leader, too. I'm glad Barton got promoted. But who the heck is Bartlett?
Don't know, don't care, I said, focused squarely on the medical crates in front of me. Actually, I did know who Bartlett was, some new guy who transferred in from the Georgia base of operations. I had overheard some of the green girls in the locker room talking about what a fine specimen he was, but they had spotted me and split before I could find out anything useful. Jude was humming now, one foot tapping out a frantic rhythm against the mats underfoot. The compass hanging around his neck had slipped out from under his jacket and was swinging in time with him. I don't think he had stopped moving the entire 5 hours we were in the air.
Bartlett got his training at West Point. Do you think that means he's good?
If you have the personnel files in your folder memorized, why are you asking me?
Because people are more than what a piece of paper or a computer file says about them. I don't really care that Bartlett's specialty is knife fighting. I mean, don't get me wrong, holy crap, but I'd rather know why he joined the league, what he thinks about that decision now, favorite food.
At that, I turned to look at him, half amazed, half horrified.
You think his favorite food is more important than knowing his preferred method of killing you in a fight? Well, yeah, it kind of is.
I couldn't stop myself, and I couldn't explain why anger flashed so fast and hot through me.
You want to know about Beta Team?
I could hear my heart hammering in my ears.
For the next 12 hours, they are the only 6 people who won't be trying to kill you. But they don't have to protect you, especially if it interferes with the op. So, follow leader's orders and keep your damn head down. That is all you need to know.
Jeez, Jude said, blinking. Not every adult in the world is trying to bury us.
My tongue was trapped behind my clenched teeth. You think killing you is the worst thing they could do to you?
I just want to know people, he explained. What's wrong with that?
Well, sorry, I said. Most of them won't want to know you.
No, I mean...
He waved his hands through the air, like that was going to unravel the mystery of whatever he was trying to say.
It's just that nowadays people are so quick to boil you down to bare bones of info and upload you into a system, you know? And I think no one can ever really know another person unless you really pay attention.
He stopped, stretching his long neck out to glance around, but our minder for the op was busy playing a game of cards with Francis.
Like, look at Rob. His file is perfect. He went to Harvard, was an Army Ranger, then an FBI agent for a while. He's 6 feet tall exactly and weighs 203 pounds. He knows how to use firearms and speaks decent Spanish. But that... nowhere in there is anything that hints at the fact that he...
Jude trailed off.
I don't want to just see someone's face. I want to know his shadow, too.
I don't think Jude had ever lost anyone before Blake. He had heard about agents killed on this mission, or on that raid, or in that explosion. But once you fully settle into the special brand of pain that comes with being separated from someone you know down to the marrow of his bones, you learn not to try.
Yeah?
I asked. And do you know my shadow? Jude looked away, down to where the heels of his comically large boots were bouncing against the mat.
No,
he said, so quiet it was almost lost to the thousands of miles of crystal blue air beneath us.
Sometimes I don't think I've even really seen your face.
It didn't bother me. Feeling left my hands, but it was only because of the cold. Not the ice that had somehow manifested between us in the span of a few seconds. My jaw only clenched to keep my teeth from shattering, not to bite back an ugly, frustrated noise. I didn't need to be liked, or wanted, or cared for. I didn't need friends, and I certainly didn't need the kid who once brought down the League's entire computer network, tripping over his own huge feet, trying to guilt me into being something I wasn't. I was fine. Just a little cold. I burrowed down just a little farther into my coat, watching him fidget out of the corner of my eye. He was wringing his hands red. Beta Team is a good group, I said finally. They'll treat you right as long as you follow their orders. Alpha doesn't give a damn, so try to make sure you're paired with another kid who can watch your back. Delta's run by Farbringer, and he likes kids.
Yeah?
Jude said, but the life had gone out of his voice. He was studying the stretch of black fabric clinging to his knees.
Ruby, he said so softly I almost didn't hear him over the roar of the plane. Did Rob pick me for this op so he could kill me?
I met Rob for the first time right after Kate had gotten me out of Thurmond. The two League agents had planned to rendezvous at an abandoned gas station, both bringing with them any kids they'd managed to free. He had claimed he couldn't get his batch of kids out, and had to escape alone to avoid being detected by the camp controllers. Kate, who was so tangled up in him, had believed it instantly. But one slip, one careless touch, and his mind had opened to mine. I had seen the truth of it. On the nights I didn't stay awake terrorized by thoughts of what had happened to Liam and Chubbs and Zoo and the girls I had left behind at Thurmond, Rob's memories came slithering in. I would see the hooded boy in the ground, his entire body convulsing as the agent shot him at point-blank range. I saw the girl's face, saw her lips move to beg for mercy, and the way the dumpster had rattled when Rob had thrown her body into it. And by the end, I would wake up feeling sick, not just for the loss of life, but because it had felt like I had killed them myself. Talk about knowing someone's shadow. Try being his shadow.
I can't stop thinking about Blake. I think about him every day, all the time. We should have told someone.
he said. Jarvan and the others would be kicked out. The League would go back to the way it was before all this happened. They're the bad ones. If you get rid of them...
That wasn't always how infections worked. Sometimes the rot spread too far to be removed with one single cut. Rob and Jarvan and the others might only be a few of many. I was so tempted to tell him the truth then, everything Cole had told me. But panicking him just to make a point was by far the stupidest course. If this was going to work, he couldn't know what the plan was in advance. I couldn't give him any chance to slip up and give us away to Rob and the others. "You'll be fine," I told him. "I'll be there the entire time." He was shaking. I don't think he heard a single word that left my mouth. How could they do this? What did we ever do to hurt them? Why do they hate us that much? I closed my eyes at the sound of Rob's booming laugh cutting through the air. "Why don't you try to sleep?" I said. "We're going to be flying for a few more hours. There's no reason we both have to be tired." "Okay," he said. "I just wish..."
"You wish what?" I asked.
"Can we keep talking instead?"
He confessed it to his knees, awkwardly drawing his feet onto his seat. "You really can't stand sitting in silence, can you?" I asked. "It actually kills you a little bit, doesn't it?" It was a long time before he replied, as if he were trying to prove me wrong.
"No," he said.
"It's just that I don't like the quiet. I don't like the things I hear there."
"Don't ask. Don't ask. Don't ask."
"Like what?"
"I hear them fighting, mostly," he whispered. "I hear him screaming at her, and the way she used to cry. But I hear it through closed doors. My mom, she used to put me in her closet, you know, because his temper was better when I was out of sight. I don't remember what she sounded like normally. Just the way she sounded then."
I nodded. "That happens to me sometimes."
"Isn't that so weird? It's been like 8 years, and I hear them, and I think of how dark and tight it was, and it feels like I can't breathe. I hear them all the time, like they're chasing me, and I can't escape them, not ever. They won't let me go."
I knew he was exhausted, and I knew firsthand what exhaustion did to your mind. The tricks it played on you, just as your defenses were dropping one by one. Ghosts don't haunt people. Their memories do.
"Will you talk until I fall asleep? Just until I fall asleep. And can you maybe never tell anyone about it? Like, ever?"
"Sure." I leaned my head back against the seat, wondering what on earth I could say to calm him down. "There's this story I used to really like as a kid," I began quietly, just loud enough that he could hear it over the roar of the plane's engines, "about these rabbits. Maybe you've heard it before?" I started at the beginning. The escape. Fleeing through the forest, meeting a new danger at every turn, the desperation that came with trying to protect everyone when you could barely take care of yourself. The boy with the bottomless dark eyes. The betrayal. The fire. The smoke. And by the time I realized I had told him my own story, Jude was fast asleep, tucked firmly into dreams. "Here's the thing about places like Boston. No matter what they were before, no matter the look of the population, no matter what businesses had flourished once, no matter what great person was born there, the city that people knew was gone. It was the loved one you saw in a rearview mirror, growing smaller and smaller the more time and distance you put between you, until even its shape became unrecognizable. Red brick buildings remained firmly rooted in the ground, but their windows had been bashed in. The grass on the common was dead in patches, overgrown in others, and scorched to ruin where there had once been trees. Grand townhouses were locked and shuttered, ice and old snow clinging to their dark stones. There was a crowded lane open on each road for cars and bikes to inch their way down, but many of the old, overlapping streets were filled with makeshift tents and the people huddled inside of them. It was bizarre to see the bright, colorful bursts of old umbrellas and children's bedsheets propped up as makeshift shelters. Some of the worse-off folks were exposed to the freezing air with nothing more than a sleeping bag or a wall to lean against.
"I don't get it," Jude said, staring through the tinted windows.
None of the streetlights were on, but there were enough fires burning that we could see the scene, and the first flurries of snow from the back of the ambulance a hospital had oh so helpfully exchanged for the Lita Corp supplies we had dropped off. "A lot of people lost their homes and housing when the markets crashed," I said, trying to be patient with him. "The government couldn't pay off its debt, and because of it, these people lost their jobs and couldn't afford to keep what they owned."
"But if everyone, everywhere, is like this, why didn't the banks just let everyone stay where they were until things got better? Isn't there something we should do to help?"
"Because that's not the way the world works," Rob called from the driver's seat. "Get used to it."
He was wearing a dark blue EMT uniform, and he seemed to relish his ability to flash the lights and sirens when people in the streets didn't move out of his way fast enough. Sitting up front with him was the one member of Beta Team who had been assigned to serve as support on our half of the op. His name was Reynolds, and I only had to take one look at Jude's face as Reynolds and Rob slapped each other's backs to know he had been one of the agents Jude had overheard plotting against us. The rest of Beta Team were three blocks ahead of us, all seven crammed into the back of an old pickup truck. They were dressed as protesters of some kind. Street clothes, ragged hair, Red Sox caps, jackets thick enough to hide the weapons tucked underneath. This professor we were looking for lived in Cambridge, just over the Charles River. Harvard's medical school, where he was conducting his research, was happily situated in the middle of Boston proper. Rob had decided, in his questionable wisdom, to divide the op into a two-prong simultaneous assault. Beta Team would handle disabling the lab, and Jude and I would break into the target's house and pull him in for questioning. At least, that's what Rob thought. We backtracked to the Longfellow Bridge, crossing the river to the sound of Jude's eager questions about baseball, the river, what the sticky substance was on the floor of the ambulance, how we were getting home, until Barton finally buzzed the comms in our ears.
"This is Leader in position, ready to commence op at 22:30. What is your status, Minder?"
5 minutes out from the goose's nest," Rob answered, and I felt the ambulance accelerate under me. My anxiety took that exact moment to wake up. I sat a little straighter, bringing my knees to my chest and wrapping my arms around them.
"Are we connected to Homefront?"
"Homefront here. Line is secure. Tracking both units now. Okay to proceed at 22:30. Satellite feed shows minimum interference at target 2. Minder, we're showing considerable activity in your sector."
I'm not sure who was more disgusted to hear him referred to as Minder, Rob or me. He didn't have a team of kids like Kate, but anyone who supervised a freak kid on an op was slapped with that title.
"There's a protest in the old man's yard," Rob said.
I looked up, scrambling on all fours to get to the back window. He was right. We were passing by the university's tree-lined park with its crisscrossing paths. Hundreds, maybe even thousands, of bodies clustered around a large bonfire, ignoring the sleet falling around them. Signs and drums littered the nearby patches of snow, the only thing between the protesters and the small ring of disgruntled police officers that had them surrounded. People seemed to be hovering at the edge of the small park, as if looking for a way to break through the line of uniforms and guns.
"What are they protesting?"
Jude whispered, his breath fogging up the glass. I didn't answer, just motioned for him to get down. I began counting the blocks we passed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The ambulance came to a shuddering stop a short distance away from the professor's pleasant little white house with a slanted gray slate roof. Rob unhooked his seatbelt and stood, stretching slightly as he climbed into the back.
"We're in position,"
he said, pressing a hand to his ear. I felt his eyes slide over to me, but I kept mine fixed firmly on Jude, who had started shaking again. This kid is going to get himself killed, I thought, pinching the bridge of my nose.
You have the all clear, said the agent monitoring the op at HQ. Goose Egg is a go.
Roger,
Barton said, and Rob echoed him. He was looking a little ragged, a dark beard coming in along the edge of his square jaw, but Rob's eyes were alert. He tossed the boy the other EMT jacket and a cap, like that could hide the fact that Jude looked about 2 years younger than he actually was.
Don't say a word, don't fidget, and follow my lead exactly, then get your ass back here, he told the boy.
Then, turning to me, he added, You know what to do? I met his dark eyes, straight on. I do. Rob needed Jude to disable the house's alarm system and man the gurney to get the professor out on the chance that any neighbors got nosy and opened their curtains at the wrong moment. We were supposed to take him around the city in a long 15-minute lap so I could work him into a state of cooperation, then dump him back on a sidewalk, his memory erased of the encounter. If he proved to be too hard to crack, Rob had a safe house we could bring him to for more painful methods of persuasion, I guess. Rob opened the back door, letting in a freezing draft of air. He and Reynolds pulled the gurney down along with a duffel bag. Jude was wringing his hands again. I grabbed his arm just before he jumped down after Rob. Be careful. Jude gave me a little salute and clenched his teeth in a way that made me think he was trying for a reassuring smile, or trying not to puke all over himself.
Later, Gator!
The door slammed shut behind them. In an hour, Sunflower. In all of the wild daydreams I'd had about the day I'd finally pack it up and leave, none of them had come close to resembling this moment. I didn't expect to feel as calm as I did. The first time I had escaped from Kate and Rob, the fear had flamed up fast and true, moving my feet before my brain could catch up. I hadn't known where I was going or how I was going to get there. I had just run. It was only dumb luck that I had found Zoo and the others. I couldn't rely on luck this time. I didn't have time to feel afraid of what would happen if I were caught. The steady composure I felt made me feel so much stronger than any of the wild, raw emotions I had surrendered to in the gas station. I had something to accomplish, and people to protect, and no one, especially not Rob Meadows, was going to keep me from it so long as there was breath in my body. The porch light flipped on as the three of them passed under it. Jude threw one quick glance back over his shoulder at me, then disappeared around the side of the porch to the little power box that controlled the house's electricity. When the porch light switched off and Rob bent over the gold door lock, I shrugged out of the League's heavy black coat, pulling out a lighter and the Swiss Army knife I had stashed in one of the pockets and tucking them in my boots. Liam's old leather jacket wouldn't keep the cold out for long, but it didn't have a tracking device in it. I climbed up to the driver's seat and popped the door open. My boots had just landed in the snow when Jude came around the back of the ambulance.
What are you?
I bolted forward, clapping a hand over his mouth. His eyes went wide in panic until I pressed a finger to my lips. Jude was too confused to process what was happening. I had to take his wrist and drag him behind me, letting the ambulance's bulk block us from view.
We're inside, came Rob's rough voice in my ear. Status, leader, on schedule, minder.
I glanced up at the street sign, Garfield Street, and tried to get my bearings. I had to put as much distance between Rob and us before he realized we were gone. I could outrun him on foot, but I couldn't outrun a car, especially not with Jude. If we could make it back to the protest, we might be able to lose him and Reynolds in the crowd. Rob wouldn't think to look for us in the one place we had a decent chance of being caught. He was a brute, and a vicious one at that, but he wasn't very imaginative. Jude panted beside me, looking slightly frazzled, but otherwise all right. The wind was knocking around his hat and tugging at mine. I pulled the black knit cap down snug over my ears, trapping my loose long hair and muffling sounds from both prongs of the op. The cold was like nothing I had ever felt in Virginia. It was sharp, a persistent clawing at every bare inch of skin. I tried picking up my pace into a faster run, blinking back the tears and snow flurries, but Jude was struggling to keep up as it was. Patches of ice snapped underfoot, branches hidden beneath the old snow crushed as I trampled through the trees separating the houses and buildings. South. 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 I just needed to keep heading south, and I'd find Harvard Yard and the protesters and escape.
Target acquired. Tangerine, is the perimeter clear?
Jude jerked toward me in wild fear, but I shook my head in warning. Rob's voice went down my spine like a match against a matchbook. The fire it lit was small, but it was burning through the tight control I had over my voice.
Oh, yeah, I said after I pressed a finger to my comm. The coast is all clear.
I knew the moment Rob opened the ambulance door, the very second he found us gone. His end of the line went silent, even as HQ and Barton were requesting status updates from him. I could see his face in my mind, white, rapidly turning purple with the effort to hold back his fury. A small smile curved the corners of my mouth. He couldn't call out for me without revealing that he had lost me in the first place. A minder's job, above anything else, was to mind the freaks under his care.
Tang...
Reynolds began to say, only to be sharply cut off. Hey, Rob, I said in a low, even voice. I saw the light from the bonfire in the yard, the new orange hue of the sky. Jude caught the back of my jacket, his long fingers twisting in the leather as he struggled to keep up with me. Snow was falling harder now. I pulled the hood of the fleece I was wearing under my jacket up over my head, stuffed my hands into my pockets, and crossed the last street.
I got a question for you.
Rue, Jude whispered. What are we doing? Where are we going?
Tangerine, keep all non-op transmissions off the line, came Barton's voice.
Good. I wanted him to hear. I wanted all of them to hear this. The ring of police and National Guardsmen had been busted open, and the protesters gathered there were streaming past them, signs clutched in their hands, drums beating. A midnight march, I guess, though I had no idea for what, and judging by the variety of signs I saw, they weren't really sure what they were protesting either. The draft that forced them into PSF service? President Gray's unwillingness to negotiate with the West Coast government? The general state of awfulness spreading like poison over the entire country as the pollution had over Los Angeles? Most of the faces around us were young, but not teenagers. A good portion of the country's universities and colleges had been temporarily shut down due to lack of funding, but if a few still had money left, I guess Harvard would have been one of them. "We are your tired, your poor, your huddled masses," read the sign next to me. I let them get ahead of us, trailing far enough behind that the others had less of a chance of hearing the chanting over the comm. I waited until they had cleared out of the square, before touching the comm again to activate the microphone. I just want to know. What were their names?
Tangerine?
Rob's voice was tight, and he sounded slightly breathless.
I have no idea.
Tangerine, cease. The woman at HQ didn't sound particularly happy with me either.
What the hell is going on, Minder?
Barton was still listening, too. Those two kids you took out of that camp, the night before we met? I said, keeping my eyes straight ahead on a young guy with dreadlocks waving us all forward. The boy and the girl, I'm sure you remember them. It must have taken a lot of effort to get them out, never mind to tie their hands and feet that way. Jude stared at me, his dark brows drawn together in confusion. It doesn't make any sense to me. You got them out, and then you killed them in that alley and left them there. Why? What was the point? What did they say or do to make you so angry? That girl was begging you. She didn't want to die, but you took her out of that camp and you executed her. You didn't even take that boy's mask off. I clenched my fists to get them to stop shaking, and in that brief second, suddenly it was Albin's voice crackling in my ear.
What's all this?
He took a deep breath.
I need you both to meet Leader. If you don't want to return to HQ with Minder...
We're not coming back to HQ, I said,
until he's gone forever.
It was a dangerous play. If Alban took the bait and booted Rob, there was still a good chance that others in his bloodthirsty pack would retaliate against the kids at HQ. But, now that Alban knew Rob was hostile, he and the agents we could trust would be on the lookout for more of that attitude, at least for the next few weeks. Jarvan and the other conspirators would feel safer knowing that Jude was away and couldn't rat them out. And I didn't need forever. A few weeks and I would be back with all we needed to force them out. Rob, listen, I just want to know their names. I want to know if you even bothered to ask before you killed them.
Do you think this is a game? Stop lying, goddammit, when I find you!
You better hope you never find me, I said, ice edging each word. I didn't even have to close my eyes to see that girl's face. I felt her walking beside me, her eyes open, forever fixed on the barrel of the gun and the hand that held it steady. Because what I'll do to you will be so much worse than a bullet in the skull. I didn't wait to hear the response to that. I yanked the comm out and dropped it, letting the feet behind me smash it and scatter the pieces. I motioned for Jude to follow me as I jogged to catch up to the protesters. We were swept into the flood of people pouring down Massachusetts Avenue's wide berth. I was being jostled from all sides. Arms were being thrust around. People were yelling and screaming. And it was the safest I had been in months. I threw a glance behind me as I surged forward, looking for Jude's pale face. There he was, eyes wide, cheeks and nose pink with the blistering cold. I was coasting on a wave of simmering power and control. I had gotten us away, and now no one was even looking at us. I felt Jude grab the back of my jacket again and guide us forward, flowing with the crowd. The drums up ahead rattled to life with a frantic rhythm, and for the first time, I felt a twinge of panic. I thought I heard someone calling my name behind me, but even the chanting was drowned out by the fury gripping my mind. The crowd around me was still growing, and the farther they moved down the street, the more they seemed to work themselves into a frenzy of excitement. The same chant was singing through their blood. More, 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 more. That was the only thing they had in common. The only thing they all wanted. More food, more freedom, more money, more. I realized where we were headed almost immediately, back into the heart of Boston. The Massachusetts Avenue Bridge was up ahead, and so were the familiar blue and red flashing lights of the police cars that were blockading it. The protesters didn't stop. There were dozens of policemen in riot gear, National Guardsmen taking aim, and not a single one of the protesters stopped marching forward. I felt my feet slow and was shoved forward by the momentum of the crushing wave behind me. The policeman in the center of all this, a grisly old man staring the rest of us down, held up a megaphone.
"This is Sergeant Bowers of the Boston Police Department. You are trespassing in violation of Mass General Law, Chapter 266, Section 120, and are subject to arrest. You are unlawfully assembled. I demand you immediately and peacefully disperse. If you do not immediately and peacefully disperse, you will be arrested. This is your only warning."
I didn't see the first stone that was thrown. I didn't even see the second or the third. But I heard the clatter of their impact against the clear shields of the riot police.
"Fire, then!"
someone was yelling.
"Fire! Fire! Fire!"
The girls around me picked up the word and began screaming it.
"Shoot! Shoot! Shoot!"
was the only rival to the chant. I took a step back, elbowing my way through the crowd's throbbing crush. They wanted the police to open fire on them? To make a point, or to capture it on video? I saw the handheld devices clutched in their stiff, frozen fingers. The snowflakes clung to the camera's glassy eyes, following the path of every rock, snowball, and brick that was launched toward the men and women in uniforms. I ducked, holding my arms over my head as I fought my way to the back of the herd. A stray elbow nailed the back of my head, and it was enough to knock me out of my haze. I reached behind me, grabbing Jude's arm as I turned. but the person holding my jacket was a short Asian girl with thick black glasses, who seemed just as startled to see me as I was to see her.
"Sorry," she shouted. "I thought you were my friend."
"Damn it." I whirled around, scanning the nearby crowd. "Where is he?" The gunshot was the only thing sharp enough to cut through the chanting, the only thing strong enough to silence them. The girl and I both jumped back, but were roughly shoved aside by the people still marching forward behind us. Maybe the officer or soldier thought the threat of it would break up the crowd, but they had seriously misjudged the anger powering these people. The protesters at the head of the pack were clearly used to this kind of bullying. I glanced back over my shoulder. They were struggling against the clear shields blocking their paths, clamoring over the hoods of the police cars. The unlucky ones were yanked back and beaten into the ground by batons.
"Jude!"
I called, my guilt nearly cutting me down at the knees.
"Jude!"
The first can of tear gas released with a sinister hiss, but it wasn't enough to shift the crowd. They only launched themselves toward the officers at a run. I felt someone try to grab my arm and haul me back around to face it with him, but I yanked myself free. "Bad plan," I thought, choking on the poisoned air. "Bad, bad, bad plan, Ruby." It was dumb luck I even saw him then. I had started turning the other way only to catch a glimpse of a curly head of hair out of the very corner of my eye. The blue EMT jacket was flapping in the wind, one sleeve torn with a ragged edge. Jude was standing on his toes, one hand on the nearest streetlight to keep himself upright, the other curled around his mouth as he shouted,
"Ruby! Roo!"
over and over again. I saw now the way that fear fed anxiety and turned it into chaos. Jude's shape went out of sight, tucked into a cloud of tear gas, hidden behind the sudden stampede of bodies trying to get away from the guns, from the smoke, from the bridge. People were screaming, and the gunfire hadn't stopped. There were new noises, too. A helicopter hovering above us, casting a light down over us. The whirring of its blades drove some of the smoke away, clearing the way for the National Guardsmen to rush toward us. For the first time, I noticed more than one black uniform in the mix. If it had been a clear night, if my eyes weren't streaming with tears, if I could have heard anything other than the thrumming thunder of my own heart, I would have noticed it sooner. The air seemed to vibrate against my skin, and I caught the whiff of ozone a second too late to do something about it.
"Jude, don't!"
The line of streetlights along the stretch of road began to buzz, their orange lights bleaching to a molten white a second before they blew out together, sending a shower of glass and sparks down on the already terrified protesters. I'm not sure anyone recognized what Jude was, not until the lights from the nearby building switched on after months or years of darkness. I reached him half a second before the National Guardsman and his gun did, throwing my shoulder into his chest and driving us both to the ground. The impact blew the air from my lungs, but I scrambled up, shielding him from the butt of the soldier's rifle. With one blow, it cracked against my skull and sent me spinning into darkness. 7. The ground grumbled beneath my cheek, a low clattering that underscored the dull pain in my brain. Feeling was slow to come back to my limbs. I took a deep breath, trying to swallow the taste of iron and salt from my dry tongue. Matted hair stuck to my neck in clumps. I tried to reach up and brush it away, only to realize that my hands were trapped behind me, something sharp digging into the skin there. My shoulders ached as I twisted to readjust myself on the van's grimy floor. It was dark in the back, but every now and then a flash of light would come through the metal grating separating the front seats from the rest of the vehicle, just enough for me to see that the uniformed driver and the man sitting in the passenger seat were dressed in black. Damn. My heartbeat was in my ears, but I didn't feel afraid. Not until I saw Jude sitting pin straight on one of the benches, his hands bound and his mouth gagged. While the PSFs had bound my hands, for whatever reason, probably because I was already unconscious, they hadn't used a gag on me, and I was grateful. Bile rose, burning the back of my throat, and the only way to make the whole thing worse would have been to choke on my own vomit. I could feel the anxiety in me building to a slow and steady beat of, not again, not again. I can't go back there. Not again. Calm down, I ordered myself. You're no good like this. Get a grip. I couldn't get my jaw to move, to say something to get Jude's attention. It took several precious moments for him to notice that I was even awake, and when he did, his body gave a huge jerk of surprise. He tried in vain to rub the cloth out of his mouth with his shoulder. I shook my head. If we were going to do something, it would have to be quietly. Jude's fear was an actual living thing. It hovered over his shoulders, black, thunderous. He began to shake violently. He tossed his head, trying to draw desperate gulps of air into his lungs. He's having a panic attack. The thought was a quiet, sure one, and I was surprised by how much resolve it flooded into my veins. It's okay, I whispered, hoping the guys in front wouldn't hear me over the chatter of their radios. Jude, look at me. You have to calm down. He was shaking his head, and I could read his thoughts clear as if I had actually been inside it. I can't. Not here. Not now. Oh, God. Oh, God. I'm here with you, I said, bringing my knees up close to my chest. It was painful, but I managed to drag my arms up around my legs so my bound hands were in front of me. Take a breath through your nose. A deep one, I said. Let it out. You're all right. We'll be fine. You just need to calm down. And he needed to do it sooner rather than later. My mind was going in circles, trying to think of where the nearest camp was. Upstate New York? Wasn't there one in Delaware, out near a whole town of abandoned farmland? Where were we now? I held Jude's gaze with mine. Calm down, I said. I need you to focus. You have to stop the car. Do you remember Saratoga? If there was only one good thing I could say about the League's methods of training, it was that the instructors were creative. They tended to have a supernatural sense of what kinds of situations we would find ourselves in, including a practice run-through of almost this exact scenario. In that simulation, Vida, Jude, and I had been on a make-believe op in Saratoga and had been taken hostage. Vida and I had fought our way out of the van and both ended up dead, shot in our escape. Instructor Fiore pointed out everything we should have done, which included Jude doing something other than cowering in the back of the car. I saw him take a deep breath and nod. When I had traveled with Zoo, the biggest hurdle she had to overcome was controlling her yellow abilities. She had worn rubber gloves for the better part of our time together to avoid zapping machinery or the car, but we'd seen her lose control twice without them to block her charged touch. Jude, though, he'd been trained. He'd had the benefit of being around other yellows who were willing to help him learn. Although he ran at a speed that was 10 times faster than everyone around him, he kept his abilities in check. The scene out by the protest had been the first time I'd ever seen him slip, and in such a huge, horrible way. He closed his eyes, and I rolled over onto my knees, trying to brace myself. I felt the huge swell of electricity, felt it ripple along the hairs of my arms. It crackled in my ears, heated the air until it burned white. It was too much for the car's battery to take. The car didn't even shudder as it died. It was like it had slammed into an invisible wall. I went sliding toward the front grate with the force of it. The two PSFs cried out in confusion. But I didn't think it through. Cars on the East Coast were rare, with the sky-high prices of gas and the cost of upkeep. I had just assumed that there would be no one else out driving, that the van would stop and I would find a way to take the PSFs out one at a time. I saw the flood of white headlights at the same moment the PSFs did. The force of the impact as the semi-truck clipped the front of our van sent us spinning fast and wild. The airbags exploded with a scent like burning. I slammed into the bench opposite of Jude, who went tumbling to the floor. The van went onto its right tires, and for a split second I was sure we'd start rolling and that'd be the end of the story. Instead, the van slammed back down onto all fours. Over the hiss of the smoking engine and the cusses one of the PSFs was hollering,
I heard the semi-truck's tires squeal as it slid to a stop.
Flowers! Flowers!
I shook my head, trying to clear my double vision as my hands felt along the ground for Jude. They didn't stop until they met with his bony, warm ankle, and I felt him twitch in response. Alive. It was too dark to see if he was in one piece.
Flowers! Goddammit!
If it had been anyone else beside the PSFs, I might have felt sorry for the trouble we'd caused them. One of the men in uniform, Flowers, I guess, was slumped forward in his seat, his deflating airbag smeared with blood.
Shit!
The driver was pounding on the steering wheel. He felt around the crumpled dashboard until his fingers latched onto the radio. Jude had done his job, though. Anything electronic within 50 feet had been fried. The man kept trying to click it on, kept saying, "This is Moreno, do you read?" The PSF must have remembered protocol, because he reached over and forced the door open, jumping out into the snow. He'd have to secure us, make sure we were all right. I was ready for him. My legs were shaking like a foal's as I dove over Jude's prone form, beating the soldier to the door. He had his gun in one hand, but needed the other one free to unlatch the back door. I had my handcuffs looped over his neck and his face between my hands before he could let out a gasp of surprise. The soldier, Moreno, was rattled enough that his brain didn't put up much of a fight. Taking control was smooth, easy, without the slightest whimper of pain in my mind. "Take our handcuffs off," I ordered. I waited for him to reach up and do it before ripping the gun out of his hand. Jude let out a blissful moan as their metal grip released. "Turn around and start walking back toward Boston. Don't stop until you reach the Charles. Understand?" My finger curled around the trigger of the gun. "Walk back toward Boston," he repeated. "Don't stop until you hit the Charles." I felt Jude at my back, swaying, but kept the black handgun trained on the PSF's head as he walked away, disappearing into the swirling clouds of snow, deep into the night. My arms began to shake, both from the frigid cold and the stress of keeping myself upright. The truck driver took his time, but he appeared at the driver's side window, pounding against it.
"Is everyone all right? I've called for help."
I signaled for Jude to stay back. The PSF was still visible as he made his way down the highway, despite his dark uniform and the pitch-black road. The truck driver spotted him immediately. I counted off his steps as he ran after him, calling,
"Hey! Where are you going? Hey!"
At the sight of him, Jude slipped the cuffs from his shaking hands, and they clattered as they hit the floor. When the truck driver spun on his heel, I was already waiting for him, gun up, hands steady. The truck driver's face went stark white under his beard. For a moment, we did nothing but stare at each other, the snow collecting in his wiry hairs. His jacket was a vivid red plaid and matched the knit cap he had pulled down low over his ears. Slowly, he raised his hands in the air.
"Kids," he began, his voice shaking. "Oh my God, are you guys?"
Jude's hand tightened around my shoulder.
"Rue,"
he began uncertainly. "Get lost," I said, nodding toward the gun in my hands.
"But the nearest town is miles away."
I saw the driver relax, his hands dropping back down to his sides now that the shock had worn off. Clearly, he thought I wasn't capable or willing to shoot him if it came down to it. I didn't know whether to be furious or grateful about it.
"Where are you going to go? Do you need a ride? I don't have much food, but it'll be warm and..."
Maybe the driver thought he was being kind. Jude obviously thought so. I barely caught the back of his jacket to keep him from jumping out of the van and throwing his arms around the man in weepy gratitude. Or maybe the driver just wanted the $10,000 per head he'd get for turning us over. "I need you to get lost," I said, switching off the gun's safety. "Go." I could tell that he wanted to say something else, but the words caught and stuck in his throat. The driver shook his head once, twice, and gave me a weak nod. Jude let out a strangled protest, lifting a hand in his direction like he could compel him to stop. The driver was slow to turn and slower to walk away.
"What did you do that for?" Jude cried. "He was just trying to help."
The thin layer of ice on the road cracked as I jumped down, snapping me back to full alertness. I didn't have time for explanations, not when the need to run was singing through my veins. The night was long, and the piles of snow in the heavy woods around us unmarred. We would have to move fast and cover our tracks. "We help ourselves," I said, and led him into the dark. The distant specks of headlights down the highway did nothing to ease up on the chill that had dug its fingers into my chest as we ran. I kept hoping to come across a car we could use, but every single one that had been abandoned on this stretch of road had a dead battery or no gas. 5 minutes of charging through the knee-deep snow of the nearby woods, following the edge of what I assumed was the Massachusetts Turnpike, finally turned up an exit sign for Newton, Massachusetts, and another one telling me it was 45 miles to Providence, Rhode Island. This was what I knew about the state of Rhode Island. It was south of Massachusetts. Therefore, we were going to Providence. And then I was going to look for a sign for Hartford, the only city I knew in Connecticut, and then one for New Jersey. And that was how my fourth grade education was going to get me down the eastern seaboard, at least until I found myself a goddamn map and a goddamn car.
"Wait!" Jude sputtered, gasping for breath. "Wait, wait, wait!"
"We need to move faster," I warned. I'd been dragging him along behind me, but I'd carry him if I had to.
"Hey!"
He let his body go limp, dropping to his knees. I jerked back with the suddenness of it, almost losing my balance.
"Come on," I snapped. "Get up."
"No,"
he cried. "Not until you tell me where the heck we're going. Barton's probably been searching for us all night."
The highway was lined on either side by hills and pockets of dense trees, but we were still far too exposed. Every time a passing freight truck bathed us in white headlights, I had to steel myself all over again. I took a deep breath. "Do you have your panic button?" I asked. "Jude, look at me. Do you still have it?"
"Why?"
he asked, patting around his pants pockets.
"I think so, but..."
"Toss it." His thick brows were drawn together, the tip of his long nose red and running with cold. He used his free arm to swipe it against his coat.
"Ruby, what's going on? Please just talk to me."
"Toss it," I said. "We aren't going back to L.A. At least not yet."
"What?"
Jude sounded small, far away.
"Are you serious? We're ditching?"
"We are going back eventually," I said, "but we have another special op first. We need to keep going before someone comes looking for us."
"Who assigned it?" Jude demanded. "Kate?"
"Agent Stewart." Jude didn't look convinced, but I had him on his feet now. "I have to recover information from one of his sources," I explained, trying to make it sound as mysterious and dangerous as I could. And it worked. The nervous look he'd been wearing changed to one of interest, and a small, fizzing excitement. "It's vital to the mission of the League, but I couldn't let Barton know the real reason for leaving. I had to figure out a way to make sure that Rob was gone by the time we get back."
"You should have told me," Jude said, "from the beginning. I could have handled it."
"It's classified, a need-to-know op," I said, adding, "a dangerous one."
"Then why the heck are you taking me?"
he asked. "Because if you go back now, they'll kill you, just like they killed Blake." I felt ashamed. The feeling snuck up on me, gripping me by the throat. I'd taken him without giving him any kind of choice, and then simplified the truth to make this reality go down that much easier. Hadn't I hated Kate for doing the exact same things to me? Had she felt as desperate to get me to agree as I did with Jude now? Jude slowed again, looking at me like he'd never seen me before.
"I was right," he whispered. "That is why he picked me. I was right."
"Yeah," I admitted. "You were." Jude nodded, working his jaw back and forth, trying to get the words out. Finally, he reached into his EMT jacket and pulled out the familiar black button, tossing it aside.
"It was dead anyway," he muttered, pulling back out of my grip. "I fried that car and everything in it, remember?"
"Right. Of course. The trackers in his clothes would be dead, too."
"All right,"
he said, his voice sounding stronger. This was the Jude I had been counting on, the one who thought all ops would be as cool as the video games he played with Blake and Nico. I reached over and brushed the snow powder from his hair and shoulders. You have to follow what I say exactly, understand? We're going completely off the grid, and no one can know where we are. Not Kate, not Vida, not even Nico. If they find us and bring us in, we ruin every shot we have at this op, at making sure the League is a safe place. As quickly and simply as I could, I laid the op out for him. Everything, from where we were headed first to what Rob and the others had been planning. I gave him a sliver of the truth, that I had been traveling with Liam for a while, but we'd split up before Kate brought me in and I'd lost track of him. Would it really be so awful to just tell him the whole truth? I was surprised there was a part of me that was even tempted to talk about those last few precious moments in the safe house. It just didn't make sense to complicate everything by letting him into that moment of goodbye. I was the only one I wanted living in it, thinking about it, dreaming of it. And, to be honest, I needed him to trust me absolutely now, more than he ever had, if this was going to work. If I told him what I had done to Liam, every look Jude would give me from that moment on would be tainted by the fear I could do it to him, too, if he could even bring himself to look at me at all. This was the kid who had sat with me for every meal when half of the League was too afraid to look me in the eye. He didn't flinch when I touched him. He waited for me to get back from ops to make sure I was safe. As annoying as it had seemed to me then, I had never thought about what it would be like to lose it. Him. Jude listened to it all, strangely calm for him. He didn't react at all when I told him what was on the flash drive Liam was carrying. At first, I thought he had stopped paying attention, but at the end of it all, he nodded and simply said, "Okay." "What's wrong?" I asked. I was fully aware of how stupid that question was. What wasn't wrong? "Are you feeling okay? Nothing bumped, bent, or broken, right?"
No. I'm fine. All in one piece, at least."
He knocked on the top of his head.
"It's just I was wondering..."
"About?" I prompted.
"About before. Before, I mean."
He turned to look at me.
"Did you have to deal with the PSFs a lot at your camp? It's just, you were so calm. Don't get me wrong, when you were all get lost, it was pretty epic, but you didn't seem, you know, scared."
My brows rose. "You think I wasn't scared?"
"I wasn't scared either," Jude added quickly. "It just made me wonder about before you came to HQ.
"Are you trying to ask me what I was doing before Kate brought me in?"
"Well, yeah," Jude said. "We all wondered. There were rumors, but they seemed really hard to believe."
"Really?
Really?"
Seeing that his line of questioning was a one-way road into Silenceville, USA, he changed the subject as awkwardly as he could manage.
"Do you really think the scientists discovered what caused it?" Jude asked. "Idiopathic, blah, blah, blah."
"Idiopathic adolescent acute neurodegeneration," I supplied, "otherwise known as the reason most of us died and the rest of us turned into freaks. How could he ever forget what those letters stood for?"
"Right, whatever," Jude said. "Oh, man! Can you imagine what the League could do with that?"
I could hear the hope underlying his voice and felt my heart break just that little bit. How could I tell him it would be a miracle if we actually found Liam, let alone found him still in possession of the flash drive?
"I think about it a lot," he said. "Don't you? There's a lot I don't understand, and Kate and the others don't really give me anything to work with, but it's sort of cool to think our brains somehow mutated. I mean, it would be slightly cooler to know how and why that happened, but still cool."
"I used to think about it when I was at Thurmond and there was very little else to focus on outside of my own misery. I spent countless days staring up at the bottom of Sam's bunk, wondering how and why any of this had happened to us, why some of us were green and others orange and others dead. But almost from the exact moment Kate got me out, I forced myself not to dwell on it. there were more important things to focus on, like surviving, not being recaptured, Liam, and Chubbs, and Zoo.
I know, it's dumb, but I've been trying to puzzle it all out. Sometimes I really do think it's a virus, and then other times, I mean, how could it be a virus or disease if it barely spread outside of the U.S., Jude was saying. What was different about us from those other kids, the ones who died?
All fair points. All distracting points. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. We have to find Cole's brother first. Jude nodded.
Man, that's going to be so weird, meeting him, I mean. I remember when he ditched. No one even noticed he was gone until they did the head count at the end of the simulation.
I glanced over. You knew Liam? Jude glanced up, his amber eyes widening slightly.
Oh, no, not, like, personally. Knew of him. He was training at Georgia HQ, and Vida and me have always been in L.A. Liam's the reason they moved all of the Psy training to California, though. Less chance for people to go missing when everyone is underground, I guess.
Right. Of course. Liam wouldn't have been in California. I was surprised at how much better the thought made me feel, knowing that he hadn't been forced to live in that dank hole in the ground.
Is Liam one of the people you search for on the PSF network every week? Jude asked. Nico mentioned it once. Are we going to look for them, too?
I felt my patience snap, like the icy layer over the snow we were crunching through. I don't think it ever stood a chance against tonight.
Because it's none of your business, I hissed. You wouldn't even be here if you hadn't waded into such deep shit. I know, okay? I know, Jude said, throwing his hands up. You don't like us. You don't like the league. You don't want to be leader. You don't want to talk about yourself or Kate or training or your favorite food or your family and friends. Fine. Fine.
Wait, what are you doing? I thought I had imagined them as we were walking. They'd been little more than distant, unidentifiable shapes. But as I guided us down the crest of the next hill, the woods suddenly pulled back, revealing a small, cramped neighborhood street. I heard Jude slide to a stop at the edge of the icy street when he saw that these houses had lights on, that there were cars in the driveways and people moving behind the window curtains, ready to mark another Wednesday as finished. A man with a beat-up truck was trying to plow the street, struggling through the thick blanket of snow. I nudged Jude back behind me again, eyes on the house directly across the street, an idea worming its way up through my haze of exhaustion. There was a small silver sedan parked in the driveway, but, more importantly, I had seen a blurry shape through the little window of the house's front door. Sure enough, as soon as the plow passed, a woman stepped out and turned to lock the door behind her. Her hair was an ashy blonde, shot through with strands of silver. It peeked out between the emerald knit cap and black coat she was wearing. I saw a flash of her dress as she buttoned her coat up over it. The cut and design made it look like something a waitress in a diner would wear. She swung her keys around her fingers as she walked, glancing up at the night sky and the snow falling in soft breaths around her. I waited for the beep-beep of the doors unlocking before I moved. Come on, I said, grabbing Jude's arm. The woman heard us coming. Her back went rigid with panic when she saw my face reflected behind hers in the car's dark window. I saw fear chase confusion in her eyes and took the opportunity to slip one of my cold hands up the sleeve of her coat to her warm, bare flesh. She smelled like pineapples and sunshine, and her mind was just as bright. It was a quick touch. It had to be. So fast I didn't even experience the usual flood of memories. I wasn't even sure I had her until she blinked slowly at me, her eyes going glassy. Get in the car, I said to Jude, looking over my shoulder to where he stood, mouth agape. We have a driver. The benefits of coercing someone to drive us were twofold. She couldn't report the car stolen and phone in the plates, and, even better, she could pay tolls and get us waved through security stations set up at town borders by the National Guard or police. After taking 2 seconds to really think it through, I compelled her to take us to whatever was the nearest transportation hub. In a perfect world, Amtrak and all of its many lines would still have been around, but the economic crash did such a bang-up job exposing its many flaws, it lasted only a year before collapsing. Now the government ran two electric trains up and down to the major cities on the eastern seaboard each day, mostly to shuttle National Guardsmen, PSFs, and senators around. The Elite Express, they called it, and tickets were priced to match its name. Train jumping would be a lot riskier than driving a car, but I couldn't shake the nightmarish image of us having to stop and siphon gas every 10 miles. It would eat away every valuable hour we needed. We could luck out and get a nearly empty train, at least for a few cities. If it looked too dangerous or the train started to feel too crowded with unwanted eyes, we could always bail early. I had a way of making us disappear. "Turn on the radio, please," I said. "One of the news stations." Jude and I were crouched behind the two front seats, nestled in the hollow of space between them and the back seat. It was awkward to sit that way and still be reaching around to touch her to maintain the connection. I took a deep breath, slowly pulling my hand away, but focusing on that shimmering line of connection between our minds. Maybe this was how Clancy worked his way up to not needing a physical touch to establish a mental connection with a person, by letting go for a little longer each time. The woman obeyed, and the speakers behind my head burst to life with the sound of a catchy commercial jingle. Amazing. They were still advertising pool supplies, even though a good portion of Americans had lost their homes. She flipped through the channels, skipping over music and static, until she reached a man's droning voice. "The Unity Summit, as it's being called, will be held on neutral ground in Austin, Texas. The state's governor, who recently denied allegations of aligning with the federal coalition in California, will moderate the talks between several key members of President Gray's staff and the coalition to see if common ground between the rival governments can be reached in time for the completion of the construction on the new Capitol building in Washington, D.C. on Christmas Day." President Gray had this to say about the possibly historic event. The voice changed abruptly from the grave tone of the reporter to the silky, easy tone of a president. "After nearly a decade of tragedy and suffering, it is my sincerest hope that we can come together now and start making strides toward reunification. My advisors will be presenting economic stimulus plans over the course of the summit, including programs to jumpstart the construction industry and return Americans to the homes they may have lost in economic calamity of recent years." Calamity. Right. "Do you think Gray will finally give up the presidency if they agree to the terms?" Jude asked. I shook my head. I didn't know Gray personally, but I knew his son Clancy. And if the son was anything like the father, Gray definitely had another motive for wanting this summit to happen. The last thing he would want to lose is control. Clancy. I pinched the bridge of my nose, forcing the thought out. The nearest Amtrak station ended up being the one in Providence, Rhode Island, an enormous concrete building that might have once been beautiful before the Times and graffiti artists found it. I glanced at the clock that had been built into its lone tower's face, but it either wasn't working or it had been 11:32 for the past 4 minutes by the dashboard clock's estimate. There were a few cars in the nearby parking lot, but at least 3 dozen people piled off a city bus that rumbled up to the drop-off lane. I touched the woman's shoulder, surprised to feel her jump. Her mind was very quiet now, as milky white as the sky outside. "We need you to buy us train tickets that'll get us to North Carolina, as close to Wilmington as possible. Do you understand?" The loose flesh on the woman's cheeks quivered slightly as she nodded and unbuckled her seatbelt. Jude and I watched her stagger her way through the new snow, heading for the automatic sliding doors. If this worked. "Why are we trying to take the train?" Jude asked. "Isn't that going to be dangerous?" "It'll be worth it," I said. "It'll take us twice as long to drive if we have to keep stopping for gas."
"What if someone sees us, or there are PSFs on the train?" he continued.
I pulled the knit cap off my head and threw it to him, along with the thick white scarf I had wrapped around my neck. When we were seated on the train, I'd be able to cover him up with my jacket. But until then, we would just have to find a dark corner. The woman came back faster than I expected, her eyes on the ground, something white clutched in her hands. She opened the driver's door and slid into the seat, letting in a breath of freezing air. "Thank you," I said when she handed me the tickets. Then, as Jude stepped outside, I added, "I'm really sorry about this." I only looked back at the car once as we headed into the station. I had told her to wait 2 minutes, then drive back to her house. The woman, maybe it was my tired eyes playing tricks on me, or the whirls of snow between us, but when the headlights of a passing car flashed through her windshield, I swear I saw the gleam of tears on her cheeks. She had been able to get us tickets to Fayetteville, North Carolina, which could have been clear on the other side of the state from Wilmington as far as I knew. Worse, the boarding time was listed as 7:45 a.m., a good 10 hours away. It was too much time to kill, too much of an opportunity to be caught. The inside of the station wasn't nearly as ornate as the outside of it was. There was too much concrete for it to be truly beautiful. I found us a bench in a corner, facing a wall of unplugged arcade games, and we planted ourselves there and didn't move, not for anything. The overnight trains came and went, feet shuffled behind us. The arrivals and departures board clicked and spun and beeped. I was tired and hungry. There was a coffee cart still open by the ticket windows, the only thing standing between the clerks and sleeve, but I didn't have any money, and I wasn't desperate enough to use my abilities on the poor guy stuck manning the cart. Jude dozed against my shoulder. Every now and then, the automated announcer would come over the speakers with an update on the time or delayed trains, but the silent gaps between them seemed to grow longer with every hour that we waited, and I was beginning to regret the decision more and more. Somewhere around 4 o'clock, right when I was teetering at the edge of exhaustion, the doubts came storming in. By the time we got down there, I wondered, would Liam still be in North Carolina? He was resourceful when he needed to be. He could cover a huge amount of distance in the time we sat here, in the time it took us to get down there. There had been cars in the parking lot. Maybe the smart thing to do was boost one of those and try avoiding the toll booths and National Guard check stations set up around the bigger cities? No, because that would also mean being spotted by the thousands of highway cameras the government had installed for the exact purpose of looking for kids like us. It wasn't the whoosh of the sliding doors opening that snagged my attention, but the heavy steps. Now and then, a few people would drift in and out of the station, and a good number of homeless had been allowed to sleep in the heated space for the night, provided they took up a corner and not a bench. But this sounded like a good number of feet. The rubber soles of their shoes squeaked as they struck the tile. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the window clerk sit up straighter. I just needed one glance over my shoulder to confirm it. Black uniforms. I grabbed Jude and pulled him down off the bench with me, putting it between us and the dozen or so uniformed PSFs pooling in the center of the station.
"Holy crap," Jude was whispering. "Holy, holy crap."
I put a hand on his shoulder, keeping him firmly planted next to me. I knew what he was thinking. The same questions were flashing through my mind. How did they find us? How did they know we would be here? How do we get out? Well, the answer to the last question wasn't to freak out and panic. In one of those rare, fleeting moments when I was grateful for the lessons the League had taught me, I took a deep, steadying breath and began to reassess the situation. There were 11 uniformed PSFs taking their seats on the benches near one of the bus gates. Two were women, and both got up to check the monitors. Their hair was neatly braided or combed back, but the men's looked freshly buzzed. More importantly, at their feet were 11 camo duffel bags, not guns. A guy at the center of the group stood, laughing loudly as he made his way over to the vending machines. The others called after him with their orders of Doritos or gum or Pop-Tarts. They weren't scanning the premises. They weren't questioning the guy in the ticket booth. They were in uniform, but they weren't on duty. "They're new recruits," I told Jude. "Hey, look at me, not them." They're taking one of the buses to go report for duty somewhere. They're not looking for us. We just need to find a quiet place to sit until our train comes. Okay? I turned my back toward the soldiers, scanning our section of the open room for a door that might be unlocked or a hallway I hadn't noticed before. I barely felt Jude stiffen again beside me, but I did feel him yank on my braid, turning my head back toward the sliding doors, just as Vida led Barton and the rest of Beta Team into the building. All of them were in street clothes, eyeing the PSFs, who hadn't seemed to notice them at all. What's she doing here? What are any of them doing here? There was no way, no way they could have tracked us.
Holy crap, holy crap, holy crap!
Jude whispered, clutching at me. At least he understood the danger of being brought back to HQ. I didn't have to explain again that Vida wasn't here to help us. I looked around frantically, from the arcade games to the Amtrak kiosks to the nearby women's restroom. This was so much worse than even I could have imagined. Half of me just wanted to sit down and give in to the overwhelming urge to burst into full-on tears. I didn't stop to break down the plan to Jude, who looked near tears himself at whatever he had just seen. There really was no plan. I dragged him after me, literally dragged him, into the small family restroom. The door squeaked as I pushed it open with my shoulder. There were no windows in the restroom, no vents big enough for us to climb out. There was one toilet, one sink, and no way out, aside from the way we came in. I reached up and switched off the lights before flipping the lock over. No more than a second later, the door rattled as someone yanked on it. I sat down on the floor, and I drew my legs up against my chest, trying to steady my breathing. Jude collapsed down next to me. I pressed a single finger to my lips. We couldn't hide in there forever. Someone eventually would realize the restroom shouldn't be locked and come with a key. So I counted. I counted out 4 minutes in my head, stopping and restarting every time I heard someone's boots clobbering by. "Come on," I whispered, forcing Jude up onto his feet. "We're going to have to run." We didn't even get 2 feet. Vida pushed herself up from where she leaned against the wall directly across from us, her brows rising along with the gun in her hand.
"Hi, friends," she said sweetly. "Miss me?"
8. Every single word that filtered through my mind was of the four-letter variety. "What are you doing here?" The triumphant smile I expected to see there never made an appearance. Instead, she gave me a once-over and snorted.
"Wow, your danger instincts are set on high fucking alert, aren't they? And they said it would be hard to find you."
I pulled the gun out of my waistband slowly and took careful aim. I let the invisible hands inside my mind unfurl, imagining them launching toward her, driving into her thoughts. But nothing. Nothing at all.
"How cute," she said. "I have one of those too."
For one long beat, neither of us moved. Her dark eyes flicked down over me, the same way they did when we sparred in training, sizing me up, wondering if I'd really do it. Neither of us saw him move. 1 minute Jude was cowering behind me, and the next he had sidled up to Vida, one hand on her shoulder.
"I'm really sorry about this."
A tiny arc of blue electricity leaped from the walkie-talkie clipped to her belt, stroking Vida's skin softly, like a snake's exploring tongue. Vida must have realized what he was about to do at the same moment I did, but she couldn't move away fast enough. Her eyes rolled back as she crumpled to the ground.
"Oh my God,"
I said, dropping down beside her to feel for a pulse in her neck.
"I just gave her a little love zap,"
Jude said, every hair on his head standing on end.
She'll come around in a minute. But Rue, tell me I just did the right thing. I don't want to leave her here. I don't think we should go without her. But she wasn't going to help, and we have to find Liam, and she would have told, and he's important."
"You did the right thing," I said. "Jude, thank you. Thank you."
"What are we gonna do now?"
Jude whispered, following me down the hallway to a room marked employees only. A A quick look around told me that the TACT team had divided. Half were upstairs, visible in the glass offices above us, and half were heading out onto the train platform. What PSFs weren't sprawled out and still on the floor were bound together in an unwilling huddle of black. We followed the long hallway to its end, narrowly missing a station worker going into the employee break room. I kept my eyes focused on the double doors at the very end of the stretch of concrete, too scared of what I would see if I tore my gaze away. I opened the right door as quietly as possible, motioning for Jude to follow. It shut with a faint click. It took me 2 precious seconds to figure out we were even looking at the bus terminal, and another 2 to see the old man in a navy uniform come hustling around the corner, a huge, wet coffee stain all down his front. Every bone in my body went hollow as I grabbed Jude's arm and hauled him closer. The man came up short of us, his already wide, panicked eyes going just that bit wider as he gave us the once-over. For 1 long, terrible moment, no one said anything at all. There was only the sound of gunfire from inside the station and the screech of car tires from the parking lot on the other side of the building. I raised a hand out toward him on instinct, but Jude caught it and pushed it down.
"Are they?"
The man, Andy, his name tag said, was having a hard time choking the words up.
"Are they soldiers?"
"They want to take us in," Jude said. "Please, can you help us?" And then Andy did the absolutely last thing I expected him to. He nodded. We rode under the bus in the luggage compartment for the first 20 minutes of the trip, until the train station and the PSFs and Vita were too distant to be caught in his rearview mirror. It was freezing and uncomfortable to be tossed around under there. We'd slide across the cold metal with every single turn, hunched over our knees and disoriented. I let Jude loop his arm through mine, adding my little bit of body heat to his. He was muttering something under his breath. I felt him shaking his head, his curls brushing my shoulder. Finally, when the road quieted, I heard what he was saying.
"She's never going to forgive us."
"Who?" I asked, my hand squeezing his arm. "Kate?"
"No, Vida."
"Jude," I began. The guilt had clocked in at record time.
"We did the same thing her sister did to her," Jude explained, cutting me off. "We just left her. She's going to hate us forever."
"What are you talking about?" Jude turned back toward me, rubbing his eyes with the back of his hand.
"Well, you know about Kate, right? How she was our CPS caseworker?"
Something heavy and slick rose in my stomach.
"You know," he said quickly, "Child Protective Services."
"Okay, maybe not." "You and Vida both?"
"Yeah," he said. "You seriously had no idea about that? Kate never told you what she used to do?"
"No, but then again, it wasn't like I had ever asked." "So she, what, pulled you out of foster homes and brought you into the League?"
"Sort of."
He leaned back against the door, sliding against me with the next big turn. I had to strain to hear him now.
"When IAAN happened, a lot of kids got turned out of their foster homes. The ones who, you know, didn't die. It was just a bad situation all around because there was no one to even claim them for burial or anything like that. Kate said a lot of the caseworkers had a hard time trying to find out what had happened to their kids. She found me before someone turned me in for the reward or I got picked up in the collections."
The collections had been a series of mass roundups of the survivors of IAAN who hadn't already been sent to camps. Any parents who felt like they could no longer care for their freak kids or wanted them to enter the rehabilitation programs of the camps just had to send them to school, and the PSF stopped by to round them up. It was the first big organized intake of kids. The next step was forcing them into the camps, whether the parents wanted them gone or not. Involuntary collection. That must have been a really scary time. I felt him shrug, but he struggled to get the next words out.
It's over. It was better than being at home anyway. Dad was a real winner.
I forced my eyes on the road.
the way he said it, with such forced brightness. And Vida? It was like I had turned a key inside of him, or he was too exhausted to try to keep it all buried.
I don't know what the deal is with her family. She has an older sister, Nadia, who was taking care of her for a while. Kate lost track of her. I guess they were squatting in some building. Vida woke up one morning to find her sister gone and the PSFs there. She thinks that her sister called her in to get the reward money.
How did Kate get to her then? I asked.
The PSFs had packed about 10 kids into this bus to ship them east to the camp in Wyoming, but the League got there first. You know the story, right?
I did, actually. The League had found themselves in possession of 5 kids they had no idea what to do with, so they started the training program. I knew Vida had been with the League for a long time, but I had no idea she was one of the Wyoming 5.
Wow. I know!
I didn't know what to say, what I could say, so I settled on, "I'm sorry." Jude made a face.
What are you sorry for? You didn't do anything. And besides, we were the lucky ones.
Kate's the one who has the hardest time. I don't think she ever got over the kids she lost, especially the ones who died in the fire.
What?
I breathed out.
It was this group home she was in charge of keeping an eye on, Jude explained. A few of the kids started showing signs of psi abilities, and the person in charge just freaked out. Kate doesn't know if one of the kids accidentally started it, or if the woman did it herself. I guess she was really, really, really religious, but like, crazy religious. When the police found her, she kept saying how she had done God's work.
There was no word for how horrible that was, so I didn't try.
Anyway, that's the whole story. Jude shrugged. The beginning, at least.
I held my breath as the bus stopped at what I assumed was a checkpoint, and someone, probably a PSF, boarded. We couldn't hear their conversation, only the heavy steps as they walked up and down the length of the bus aisle over our heads. A more thorough soldier would have forced him to open the luggage compartment, too, but we were waved on, and soon the only sound was the growl of the road beneath us. Still, he apologized repeatedly when he pulled over to retrieve us. I had every intention of wiping his memory and booking it, but there were no cars. There was nothing on that stretch of highway aside from trees and snow. It was either Andy or another fun day or two wandering around with Jude in a winter wonderland, looking for civilization.
Are you sure this is okay?
Jude and I had taken one of the front seats to have a better look at the road while he was driving.
Can we repay you somehow?
Don't get me wrong, Andy said. This is a spectacular waste of gasoline. But I don't mind sticking it to my fine employer every now and then. They cut my benefits the hot second things got bad, so I'm not feeling too generous toward them myself. Besides, the drive down is usually pretty empty, and I have to bring the bus to Richmond whether I have passengers or not. The return trip is usually pretty full. Some folks seem to have the notion that there's more work up north than there is in the south, and hardly anyone can afford those stupid trains.
Jude had proven to me about 6 times over in the past day just how naive he was, so it was a wonder he could still surprise me with his carelessness. After a few minutes, he dropped off into an easy, trusting sleep, like there was no danger of this bus driver using his radio to call us in or driving us to the first functioning police station he happened across.
"You look like you're about to roll right off that seat and hit the floor, young lady," Andy said, glancing up at me in the large mirror over his head. "Maybe you'd consider taking a cue from your friend and getting a little rest."
I knew I was being rude and irrational and all sorts of sour, but I kept my eyes fixed on the bus's radio and frowned. Andy glanced down, following my gaze, then started to chuckle.
"You're smart," he said. "I guess you'd have to be in this day and age to be out wandering around. Oh, toll booth coming up, better get down."
I slipped down between the metal guard and the seat, adjusting the blanket over Jude's sleeping form.
Andy waved back to whomever had let him through. Finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. "Why are you helping us?" I asked. Andy chuckled again.
"Why do you think?"
"Honestly," I said, leaning forward, "because I think you want to turn us in for the reward money." The bus driver let out a low whistle at that.
"That is a nice chunk of change, I will admit. Funny that the government can dig up the cash for that, but can't afford any sort of assistance for food."
He shook his head.
"No, sweetheart, I have a job. I make do. I don't need the guilty conscience or the blood money."
"Then why?" I demanded. Andy reached over with his left hand, plucking something off his dashboard. The tape around it peeled off without protest, like it was used to being lifted and then stuck back on. He held it out, waiting for me to take it. A little boy smiled back at me from the glossy surface of the photo, dark hair gleaming. He looked 10, maybe 12, if even that. I recognized the muted colors of the backdrop behind him. A school portrait.
"That's my grandson," Andy explained. "His name is Michael. They took him from his school about 4 years ago. When I tried to contact the police about it, the government, the school, they wouldn't tell me anything. Same for everyone. Couldn't post about it online without my access being shut off. Couldn't go on TV or write into the papers because Gray was all over them, too. But some of the parents at his school, they said they overheard some PSFs talking about a place called Black Rock."
I wiped the smudged fingerprints from the photo's surface and handed it back to him.
"You're right," he said. "I'm not entirely selfless. I guess what I'm hoping is that maybe you can give me some information. Maybe you know what or where this Black Rock is, and we can call it even."
It was the pleading quality to his voice that did me in. I couldn't detach it from the thought of my own grandmother, left wondering what had happened to me. My skin felt tight around my chest. "I do. Black Rock is a camp in South Dakota."
"South Dakota?"
Andy sounded astonished.
"All the way out there? You're sure?"
I was more than sure. The League had a list of all 15 camps the surviving Psy kids were divided among. Some were itty-bitty, a couple dozen kids. Some were converted schools that could hold a few hundred. Then you had camps like Black Rock and Thurmond that, because of their remote location, could hold thousands. The South Dakota camp was of special interest to the League because of the rumors surrounding it. All new births from the time IAAN was officially recognized had to be registered in a special database. Those children were supposed to be brought into local doctors or scientists every month for tests so they could chart any abnormalities. Any child that developed psi abilities before the age of 10 was put into a special study program run out of Black Rock. The other kids, if they survived IAAN and developed their abilities on the normal schedule, were forcibly picked up and brought to the normal rehab camps. "They might have transferred him at some point," I said. "Do you know what he is?"
"What do you mean, what he is?" Andy said, turning slightly. "He's my grandson, that's what he is."
I only meant to find out if he was one of the dangerous ones, a red or orange like me, to see if there was a chance he had already been erased, permanently.
"These camps,"
Andy began, shielding his eyes from the headlights of a passing truck.
"You know what they do there? Have you seen one yourself?"
I glanced sideways at Jude.
"Yeah." "And they let you out because they fixed you?"
he asked, and the hope in his voice broke my heart.
"You're better now."
"They can't fix us," I said. "All those kids they took aren't doing anything other than working and waiting. I only got out because someone helped me escape." Andy nodded, like he had already suspected as much.
"These are terrible times,"
he said after a long while.
And you're right not to trust any of us. What we've done, what we allowed them to do to you, it's a shameful thing. A shameful, shameful thing. And we'll go to our graves knowing it. But I want you to know that for every person who would turn in a kid out of fear or for funds, there are hundreds and thousands more who fought tooth and nail to keep their families together. I know. It's just, they were such bad times then, and the government kept saying. They kept going on about how if parents didn't send the kids to go through the programs, they would die like all of the others. Then it wasn't a choice at all. They knew we couldn't do anything to get them back. And it kills me. It kills me.
Did people really think the rehabilitation programs were going to work? I asked. Jude shifted in his seat, trying to get more comfortable.
I don't know, sweetheart, Andy said, but I think they hoped like hell they would. You get down to nothing. No money, no work, no house, and hope is all you tend to have left, and even then it's a rare commodity. I doubt anyone believes the lies these days, but what can we do about it? We have no information to work with, only rumors.
It hit me then, how equally important it was for me to find Cole's flash drive as it was to find Liam. All along, I had been thinking of it as this little plastic device, not sparing much thought to the value of what was locked inside of it. Finding Liam mattered to me, meant everything to me, but finding Cole's data, that would help everyone. That had the potential to reunite families, loved ones. I'm going to get every kid out of every camp, I said. I'm not going to stop until they all get home. Andy nodded, keeping his eyes on the road ahead.
Then we're more than even.
The conversation died out, and the radio came on. I watched the sunrise, the colors lighting the horizon, a mellow pink, feeling sick to my stomach with exhaustion. But still, I couldn't fall asleep. I pulled Liam's leather jacket up over me like a blanket and felt something slip past my hand out of one of the pockets. The two train tickets the woman had bought floated lazily to the ground, one facing up, the other down. Stay. The word had been scribbled several times over by pen on the back of one of the tickets, the letters wild and jagged, and with each stroke, darker and deeper. I picked them up, checking the other ticket. Safe. Stay safe. Apparently, I hadn't had as firm of a grip on that woman as I thought. It was stupid of me to feel so frightened and anxious when she was hundreds of miles away, but I couldn't stop myself from picturing the worst. How she could have warned everyone about the terrors in her back seat. She could have gone into that train station and run, or called us in to every nearby skip tracer. She could have had the reward, the satisfaction of knowing we were off the street and out of her hair. But instead, she had done this. Andy had done this. I ripped up the tickets before Jude could wake up and see them. I didn't want to give him the false hope that these people were anything other than lone candle flames in a sea of never-ending black. Jude was still singing, literally singing, the praises of his new hero, Andy, when we saw the first signs for Wilmington. Just after he'd dropped us off near Richmond, he'd given us detailed instructions on the right highways to avoid on the way down. I'd been too flustered and annoyed with the delay to thank him at the time. Now, every clear road our little stolen car flew down filled me with a sharp pang of regret. Wilmington kissed the Atlantic on one side and a river on the other. It surprised me to see how similar it was to the parts of Virginia that I knew. The style of the houses, the way the neighborhoods were laid out, even the way the sky grayed out over the roofs, darkening until the clouds finally burst and it began to rain. The address Cole gave me, 1222 West Bucket Road, Wilmington, North Carolina, was in a little neighborhood called Dogwood Landing, not too far from what I assumed was a university campus. It was a quiet part of the city,
surrounded by frosty woods and filled with a good number of empty lots and crooked, weathered, for sale signs. I picked one and parked the green Volkswagen we'd stolen after parting with Andy in front of it.
"Is that it?"
Jude asked, peering closer at the nearest house. "No, it's a ways down, I think." I took a deep breath, wondering how it was possible to feel excitement and dread in the same breath. "I want to approach from the back in case anyone is watching the front." That had been the reason why Liam and the others hadn't gone straight home after escaping Caledonia, right? I was torn about it. Albin's advisors were always reminding us how overstretched the PSF forces were, but Liam was a priority catch. What were the chances that the government would still have someone posted here, watching Liam's parents a good 9 months later? God. Liam's parents. What the hell was I going to say to them? I signaled for Jude to follow me around the side of one of the houses. Most were on the smaller side, just one story, with gray slanted roofs, brick faces, and white trim. I pulled Jude closer behind me as we made our way through the trees, following a small dirt access road that ran alongside the houses' backyards. Liam's house was nestled deep into a pocket of trees, set a ways off from the other houses on the block. It was a similar creature to the other homes around it, with sweet blue shutters and a long driveway leading up to the garage. What I really needed was a view of the front. I held Jude back and forced him to crouch down beside me, and we watched. We looked for surveillance cameras, for footprints and tire tracks, for the undercover PSFs to come strolling around on patrol.
"It looks..."
Jude began, hesitating. "Empty," my mind finished. It looked like no one was home, and the way the gutters were clogged with fall leaves and grime made me think they hadn't been back in some time.
"Maybe they just ran out to do some errands," he offered.
"At 4 in the afternoon on a Thursday? Seems sketchy," came a new voice behind us. The girl was a snake. It was the only explanation for how silently she slithered up through the leaves.
"Leader," Vida said, nodding as she crouched down behind us. "Judith?"
Jude actually fell over.
"What are you..."
I began.
"How did you..."
She couldn't have just guessed where we'd be. She was good, but she wasn't that good. I must have missed a tracker. Something.
"The collar of the undershirt," Vida said, nodding toward Jude. "Next time you decide to cut it and run, make sure you get all the damn trackers."
"Trackers?" Jude repeated, looking between us. "Jude fried the car," I said, "and everything electric inside of it, including, I had assumed, the trackers in his clothes."
"That would be why they coat all of the yellow's trackers in rubber," she said, shaking her head. "God, you didn't know that?"
She was clearly proud of herself, despite looking like she had just been ridden hard and put away wet. Her blue hair was twisting into its naturally curly texture. I hauled Jude closer, unzipping his coat to feel around his undershirt stitching. Sure enough, I felt the small bump, no more than the size of a grain, sewn into the collar. I cut it out with my Swiss Army knife and held it for him to see. Before he could grab it, I crushed it with the hilt of the knife.
"They put trackers in our clothes?"
Jude looked between us in disbelief, though it was clear he was talking to himself.
"Why would they do that? That can't be..."
Vida looked like she was about to burst into her particular brand of cruel laughter, but her expression changed, narrowed, somehow. Her full focus shifted behind us, and she rose back onto her feet, swinging her gun up out of its holster in one smooth motion. I turned, my hair tumbling down around my face as I scrambled back onto my knees for a better look. The world dropped. I actually felt it cave under me. Felt every bone and muscle in my chest fall with it. I don't know how I managed to pull myself back up or how I came to be standing, but I was too numbed by shock to care that I was in full sight of whoever might have been watching. Then I was running. I heard Vida and Jude call after me, but the wind and rain carried their voices up and away, and I wasn't hearing anything over the thrum of blood in my ears. I shoved my way down the slight roll of the hill, through the tangle of tree branches, through the collapsing fence, through to him.
He slipped out of the window, climbing through the torn, dark screen one leg at a time until, finally, his shoes sank into the mud below. His hair was longer than I remembered it, the bones in the profile of his face sharper. He had gotten larger, or I had become smaller, or memory really was a lie. It didn't matter. He heard me coming and spun around, one hand going for something inside of his heavy camo jacket, the other for something in the waistband of his jeans. I knew when he spotted me. Every part of him froze. But then his full lips began to work, silently, until they finally settled on the tiniest of smiles. My feet slowed, but didn't stop. I was breathing hard. My whole chest heaved with the effort to keep the air moving. I pressed a hand hard against my heart. Exhaustion and relief and the same bitter terror I had felt the afternoon I'd lost him came flooding in. I just didn't have the strength to fight them back anymore. I burst into tears.
Oh, for the love of...
Chubb shook his head and sighed, but I heard the affection in his voice all the same.
It's just me, you dumbass.
And without another word, he crossed those last two steps between us and wrapped me up tight in his arms. 9. The problem was, once I started, I couldn't stop. I felt every bit of me sag against him, needing the reassurance that he was solid, and that the heart beating next to my ear was his. Chubbs patted my back awkwardly as I buried my face in his jacket and went to pieces.
How?
I choked out.
Why are you here?
The rustling in the trees behind us barely registered in my mind, but Chubbs looked up, calling,
Aw, come on, Lee. I know you want a hug, too.
It happened too fast for me to warn him, to stop any of it. Chubbs released me, only to spin me behind him, throwing me more off-kilter than I had been before. I thought for sure that my mind was playing tricks on me, because it looked like he had pulled a long hunting knife up out of the waistband of his pants. It looked like Vida was pointing her gun straight at him, switching off the safety.
It's...
I began, feeling his arm strain under my grip.
Chubbs!
Who the hell are you?
He demanded.
Not the person who brought a knife to a gunfight,
Vida said, waving her weapon for emphasis.
Wait, wait, wait,
Jude said, popping out from behind the tree to her right. He slid partway down the muddy hill, throwing himself between them.
Not Liam,
he said, pointing at himself, then at Vida.
Not Liam either.
Jude turned back toward Chubbs, his thick eyebrows drawing together as he moved his finger our way.
Also not Liam?
At that, Vida turned to stare at him.
In what universe does this tool look anything like Cole Stewart?
Jude's voice went high when he got defensive.
I don't know! Brother from a different mother? There is such a thing as adoption!
Chubbs lowered his knife. I could see his mind working behind his eyes, jumping from one horrible possibility to another, as he took account of the strangers, my tears, and the absence of Liam.
Oh my God,
he said, going gray in the face. He pressed a fist against his stomach, like he was about to be sick.
Oh my God.
No, no,
I said quickly.
He's not dead.
That you know of, my mind whispered.
Why aren't you together?
Now he looked close to tears himself. Chubbs's hair had grown out past its usual neat crop, and the silver-rimmed glasses that actually fit his face made him look so much more mature than I remembered. He didn't really look like himself, not until I saw the fear come crashing over him. This was the Chubbs I remembered, always between one panic and the next.
He never would have left you. Never.
I looked away. Not toward Vida and Jude, who had gone silent watching this, but to the soft mud cupping rain puddles at our feet.
Ruby,
Chubbs began, his voice strained.
What happened?
I shook my head, pressing my freezing hands to my face.
You left him? He guessed. You had a fight? You split up for a few days?
By whispering it, I was hoping I could take some of the sting out of the truth. But that wasn't the case at all.
Chubbs took a stunned step back, his eyes flashing with horror.
No, you didn't, he said, gripping my shoulders. That was the only reason I thought it would be okay. I thought you two would stay together.
What was I supposed to do? I demanded, not caring that my voice was rising. You were dead, and they had taken us in, and I made a deal, and I knew he wouldn't go otherwise. What the hell was I supposed to do?
Chubbs shook his head. And these kids? Their league? You're with them?
I started to say. Still standing here, waiting for an explanation as to who the hell this is? Vida cut in, every trace of amusement gone from her face.
My brain was finally starting to reassemble itself into working order, and with it came fresh, sharp fear. Vida was here. Vida, who had been chasing us down to bring us back into the league. Vida, who had now seen Chubbs and could identify him to the league if it came to that. Who might even try to bring him in. I pushed him back, trying to keep him behind me. He's no one, I said. He's not any concern of yours.
Yeah, he freaking is, if he's coming with us to find Stuart, Vida said.
What did you say?
Plug your empty-ass brain in, she said. I'm not here to take you back. I'm here to help you.
She turned on Jude. Nice of you to repay me by electrocuting me, you little shit.
If you weren't there with Beta Team and Barton to take us into HQ, then why?
Vida rolled her eyes, but did answer eventually, with the smuggest look possible. I was looped in on your little romantic quest. The only way to get me out without it looking suspicious was to suggest that I come after you dumbasses, since I supposedly know your crappy personalities so well.
What about Beta Team? Jude asked.
Recalled to HQ. Orders to bring Rob back in or something. You two lace panties about caused a fucking riot back home with your little stunt. She tossed her hair back. Albin gave me 2 weeks to find you, so let's get this horror show on the road.
I stared at her, shaking my head.
You are so full of it. You think we're just going to skip away with you into the sunset?
No, Vida said. I expect you to fucking prance, and you're going to do it with a smile and the least amount of bitching possible, or Cole isn't going to honor your stupid deal to have the league free the camps.
It was true, then. She was telling the truth about being here to help us.
Cole wouldn't have looped her in otherwise. The objective was too valuable.
It surprised me how much it stung my pride to know he didn't think I could handle this op on my own, that I needed backup.
Jude turned to look at me, totally lost. Okay, vámonos, Vida said, clapping her hands. If you're going to check out the house, then do it fast.
I'm not going anywhere with you, Chubbs cut in.
I recognized the expression on his face. How many times had I seen it after the others took me in, before he came to accept the fact I was staying with them? Chubbs had never been one to hide his feelings, whether it was anger or fear or suspicion. He and Liam were alike in that way, only it came to Liam by nature and Chubbs by choice. I'm not sure he saw a point in pretending to be anything he wasn't.
Yes, I said, taking Chubbs' arm again. I felt the muscle there strain under my fingers.
Come on, we need to talk. I'll explain everything.
Chubbs cast his unhappy expression down at me.
Just us, then.
All four of us heard it at once. Car doors slamming. 1, 2, 3. I pulled Chubbs back so we were flush against the house, motioning for Jude to come toward us, and quickly. Vida circled around the nearby trees, her boots silent in the soft mulch. Her head of bright hair was the last trace of her to vanish into the rain. I glanced up at the window Chubbs had wiggled out of, my hand stretching up to touch the loose screen, then back toward the woods. We could maybe make a run for it, maybe? Try to disappear into the wildlife and lose them that way?
Is it Barton?
Jude was whispering. Chubbs and I both shushed him. The back of Liam's house was lined with 5 white-trimmed windows and 1 perfectly sweet little screen door, which had been nailed into place with sturdy plywood boards. A square of bricks had been lovingly placed to serve as a patio at the back entrance to the home. Now, green grass, glowing in the misty rain, had crawled up through the cracks. I dropped to the damp bricks on hands and knees, slowly working my way along the length of the house until the voices became louder. My nails dug into the fabric of my pants, ears straining. Two men, one woman. When I finally turned back around to tell the boys this, Vida was already there, crouched between Chubbs and Jude. When she felt my eyes on her, she glanced up and gave an impatient jerk of her chin.
"There are four altogether," she whispered. "One woman, three men. They look like they're PSFs."
I covered Jude's mouth with my hand.
"Are they armed?"
She nodded.
"The usual. What's with this house? Why is it important enough that they installed motion sensors?"
"Sensors?" Chubb said.
"They stuck them under the roof overhang at all four corners of the house," she said,
clearly annoyed he didn't immediately take her word for the gospel truth. I shared a glance with Chubbs, letting Jude pry my hand away from his face. Of course they would have installed something to monitor the house. If not for Liam, then for Cole. Interesting that Cole hadn't bothered to feed her any of his brother's backstory. Maybe there just hadn't been time. The voices had quieted down, but I heard their heavy tread through the overgrown garden at the right end of the house. They'd be too close now for us to try to run out into the trees. There was no way they wouldn't spot us. With a sigh that shook his entire tall frame, Chubbs stood and pushed the dangling flaps of the window screen aside. Resignation made his shoulders slump.
"Do you trust me?"
he asked, seeing my expression.
"Of course."
Jude made a small noise behind me, but I ignored it.
"Then tell your friends to get inside."
He nodded to the now open window.
"And stand up. I'm going to have to handcuff you."
Here was the nice thing about being shocked senseless. I didn't have to pretend to be terrified. I stood there, feeling the sharp edges of the clear plastic ties cutting off my blood supply at the wrist. I let them disconnect every single thought in my head. "Who is this person?" I thought, studying him closer now. He was wearing the hooded camo hunting jacket I had vaguely noticed before, a gray wool turtleneck, and a pair of faded jeans, battered by dust and long wear. Strapped to his hip was what looked like a small cell phone and a leather pouch. When we had traveled together before, he had kept all of his possessions in a battered leather briefcase he had found. That had suited him so much better than this weird imitation of what he thought a hunter should look like. It should have been reassuring to see him so prepared and well supplied, but somehow it only frightened me more. Chubbs's hand was steady as he took my chin in his hand, turning it to and fro, inspecting the cuts and bruises from the night before with a disapproving look. The others watched from behind the closed window, Jude's face so close it was almost pressed up against the glass.
"It might be better if you pretend to pass out," he said.
The suggestion came just in time. As I hit the ground, I saw the flash of black as the PSFs rounded the corner. Four. Vida had been right. The brown-haired woman was the tallest of the group, standing several inches above the men. One was an older guy, his hair puffing out in an ashy blonde ring around his head. The other two were younger and looked enough alike to be brothers, all armed with standard-issue rifles, handcuffs, the works.
"Can I help you?"
Chubbs's face was set in stone. The soldiers didn't know what to make of us, but they also didn't lower their weapons. I was starting to put it together, though, long before Chubbs began to speak again.
"What? So you're here to swipe my score out from under my nose? Trying to weasel out of having to pay me?"
The older soldier cocked a beetled brow.
"You're a skip tracer."
"My thoughts exactly." If that was the ruse we were running with, we were in more trouble than I thought. On a good day, Chubbs was about as threatening as a potted cactus.
"Here!"
He reached into the leather pouch on his belt and thrust something at the PSF. It looked like a small booklet, about the size of a passport. The old man stepped forward, but turned to look back at the woman.
Take a walk around the perimeter. Make sure she was traveling alone.
Chubbs waved the booklet again as the three others took their walk. The old man sighed, glancing back and forth between Chubbs's face and whatever was written there.
All right, Mr. Lister, he said, passing it back to him. Have you run this one through the database?
She's not in it, Chubbs said. She's probably been coasting for quite some time. There aren't any records of her.
Did you test her? He asked. If she's blue or yellow, you'll need...
She's a green, Chubbs interrupted. Why? Want a demonstration?
We can take her, the man offered. Save you the trouble of transporting.
I told you she's not in the system, Chubbs said, the nasty edge to his voice more pronounced. I know how this works. You can't line up my payment if she isn't registered. I have to go into the nearest station and do the paperwork if I want the bounty.
The man snorted, but didn't try to deny it.
Was that car on the road yours?
No,
Chubbs said, rolling his eyes. I flew in on a cloud and came blitzing down from the heavens like a bolt of lightning on this kid.
Hey, now, came the PSF's gruff reply. I can take her and there's not a damn thing you'd be able to do about it, so watch your attitude, boy.
That attitude was what was throwing me off, too. Chubbs wasn't brave by nature. Courage tended to rear up when he felt that his friends were threatened, true, but this wasn't so much bravery as it was recklessness. And that was the last, the very last thing I associated with him. I don't know how much time passed between then and the moment the PSF's radio buzzed. A minute, 10 years, forever.
This is Jacobson, do you read?
The man unclipped his black walkie-talkie from his belt.
I read. Did you find anything?
No, nothing out of the ordinary. It's hard to tell much with the rain coming down. Any footprints would be washed out. Over.
She's alone. I'm sure of it, Chubbs was saying. I followed her.
All right,
the man said. I saw his boots sink that much deeper into the dead, muddy grass as he took 2 steps toward me. My eyes squeezed shut again, and it was near impossible to force my body to go limp with him so close. I didn't want him touching me. Panic flared up bright as morning light as his boot nudged my ribs. The cold, wet leather of his glove closed around my upper arm, and he yanked me off the ground. My arm twisted, sending sharp, shooting pains into my shoulder.
Don't! Chubbs snarled. Don't touch!
The PSF's grip didn't ease up.
I mean...
Chubbs began again, this time his voice neutral.
They take out the cost of medical care from the reward money if the kids are injured. I can handle it from here.
Sir.
That's better, the man said, dropping me face down into the dirt. Get her and clear the hell out of here. You're trespassing, and if I find you back here, I'll arrest you myself.
The rainwater was collecting in my ear, running free down the curve of my cheek and soaking Liam's old jacket. I waited for it to carry my fear away, too, down into the earth where it couldn't touch me again. I took in 1 deep, wet gulp of air and held it. A car engine started in the distance. I opened my eyes again.